fire burn.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk to our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, about some of the bills working its way through the state legislature. I mean, some really ugly stuff, if you stop and think about it. This whole nonsense, this, oh, we need more English-only stuff. We need to make Pennsylvania an English-only place. Don't we have more important things to do? I mean, job creation, isn't that something more important? Just a thought. We're also going to talk about the voter ID stuff and Dominic Pileggi's and Tom Corbett's wish to change the way the electoral votes are distributed. And, you know, basically, you know, another one of these rigging the games, you know, to help your side. And, you know, you got to give them credit. They are going to do whatever it takes to control this nation and to, you know, bring on the wrecking ball. So it'll be interesting talking to him in the second hour. Ernest Drucker is going to be here. He's a scholar and resident researcher at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University in New York. I'm going to talk about his book, A Plague of Prisons. You know, talking about this whole prison industrial complex. How did we get here? Who did it? Why? And who benefits? Because I got to tell you, I keep thinking about that guy last night with the meat. Going into the Walmart and you know, eating some raw meat out of the case for, I guess, $25 worth, they're claiming. They're going to charge this guy with a felony, which means he's going to go to jail and actually do real time for eating meat. There's got to be another penalty. But, I mean, you stop me to think about the amount of money that's going to cost us, you and me, the taxpayer, to lock this dangerous criminal up, this raw meat-eating criminal. Wow. Also, Reverend C.J. Hawking, she's going to be here, Executive Director of Arise Chicago. I'm going to talk about the Hyatt strike that I guess is wrapping up today. You know, again, you know, you look at these big, very profitable corporations and how badly they treat their employees. And look, you know, sometimes you can get into, well, all corporations are bad, and I'm not going to go there. But when you look at a company like this one, a very, very profitable one that wants to cheat their employees, treat them like slaves, they have such high injury rates from what I've been reading, at some point, people say enough is enough. And they do something about it. And good for them. So we'll talk about that with the Reverend Hawking. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-7425, 1-888-520-RICK. So, again, last night, not a good night for Democrats in New York or in Nevada, for that matter. But, you know, to be honest, the Nevada thing was never going to go the Democrats' way. That was pretty much a lock for the Republicans. But New York, interesting. I mean, the Democrats had a 3-to-1 registration edge in that district, in Anthony Weiner's former district, and they lost. Now, the Republicans are spinning this as, you know, this is all coming down on Obama. The reality is voter turnout was exceptionally low. So I'm thinking, you know, the Jerry Springer congressman. It's going to be a very short-lived time in Congress, about 14 or 15 months. I don't think he's going to be a permanent fixture, especially in a district 3-1. And I wouldn't be surprised to see somebody, I wouldn't be surprised to see Wiener go back. I hope he does. Because at the end of this, next November is, to me, one of the most important times in this country's history. If we, as a nation, make another mistake like we did in 2010, and a lot of people stay home, and you allow the energized radical right and their wrecking ball policies to walk in the door, that could be generations of harm. You know, they say, next election will take care of it. Next election will take care of it. I think that the next president appoints at least two Supreme Court justices, at the minimum. And if that happens, that fundamentally changes the direction this country goes. Do we continue on the path of a nation of, for, and by we the people, or do we make that rightward turn to being a country of, for, and by we the corporation, Mr. and Mrs. Exxon, Mr. and Mrs. Mobil? I don't know. But again, the election in Nevada was never going to go the Democrats' way. Dean Heller moved up to the Senate. He was a Republican from Carson City because Ensign resigned, being disgraced, and the election replaced him. So another radical in his place. So good times in the House. So yesterday we talked a little bit about the poverty numbers, and it has peaked to really, I guess, a 52-year high, they're saying. The fact that we've got poverty levels taking us back. The whole Great Society thing pretty much wiped away now. And to be honest, had we not had those programs, had we not had those policies in place, it would have been much worse. But they're talking about some of the income numbers. The fact that men, working class men, have seen their wages fall all the way back to 1978 levels. That's how far down the working class in this country is being pushed. And the middle class incomes are falling at record levels. And yet we've got Republicans and we've got Democrats and we've got people who are saying, well, we really can't do a jobs bill. We really, things are a little, we're skeptical. We don't really want to get into that because, the last one didn't go so well. And I'm saying you've got to do something bold. You've got to do something to jumpstart this economy. Maybe this jobs bill isn't, and I don't think it's enough, which is amazing to me. But what it is it's basically telling Republicans everything you've wanted for the last 30 years, all of these tax cuts, all of these programs, all of this privatization, all of these P3s, all of the stuff you wanted, here it is in one big ball of wax. And you've got Republicans and a lot of Democrats saying, no, thank you. I mean, there are going to be Medicare cuts in this. They're taking money away from Social Security. I know Dr. Madeline said last night that they're going to be replacing it, but I don't see that ever going back. So this is exactly what the Republicans want, and they would be, in my opinion, stupid not to take it. There is an opportunity to hit all of their main goals. But what do they choose to do? Instead, they want to have hearings on the solar panel place. They want to have hearings on Obama's drunken uncle. They want to hold up the FAA funding so that more people are going to lose their jobs, because that's the goal. Make this economy worse. Make it more strenuous. Make it more difficult for people to make a living. This way it looks bad in Obama. And none of those people who stood on the stage in Tampa the other night, none of them deserve to be president. None of them are good enough to hold the White House. I can't imagine anyone saying, yep, they can lead the country. Not one of them. So Obama was in North Carolina today. Went to North Carolina State University, and he was had another rally, and you got to give the guy credit. He is out there. He's doing what he should have been doing from the beginning. Out talking to people, doing what he does best, getting out in front of crowds, having the conversation, saying, look, you got to put jobs, you got to put the country ahead of your political gains. He said that the time for gridlock and games are over. The time is now for action. And I agree. You know, now is the time that we should be doing everything in our power to get people back to work. And the Republicans, all they've brought to the table is the same failed, tired policy. And yet I've had no one explain to me how cutting spending, how cutting government jobs, how more tax handouts to the very wealthy, how more tax breaks for corporations, how that's possibly going to create any jobs. Because we've seen over the years, time and time again, every one of these policies that they're still advocating fall flat on its face. And they say, oh, we love small business. We love the little guy. Yet their definition of small business is Halliburton. You know, the reality is when I think of a small business, I think of someone like me who hires one or two people. I think of the guy, the plumber that came to my house the other night who hires a handful of people. That's a small business to me. Halliburton, not so much. Now, I was looking up before the show started. I was looking up the numbers on what the government defines as a small business. And a manufacturer with 500 to 1,500 employees is considered a small business in this country. I think we have to define properly exactly what it is we're doing and who we're trying to help. And instead of saying, here's some tax breaks, instead of saying, here's some handouts, say, here's some demand. We need something. You go do it. We need Granny's house painted. Go do it. Just seems like common sense to me. And what we have a political system based on who's going to win the next election, not what's good for the country. And it's disheartening, and it's, you know, you can look at this and go, this is why the system's broken. And the, honestly and truthfully, the Tea Party, I guess, is right. The system kind of is broken, and look who broke it. The radical right will not concede a bit. It's their political ideology. There's going to be no give there. But I guess this is why we have elections, and which is why 2012 is so important. But you got to stay involved right now. In fact, when we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, about these you know, more bills coming from the radical right. Rosemary Schwanger has a House Bill 361, and Scott Perry has House Bill 888. And if you put them side by side next to each other, they are identical. There's a word changed here or a phrase changed here, but they're verbatim. Somebody wrote them, and I don't think it was either one of those two. But again, we're debating whether we're going to make the Commonwealth's going to be an English-only state. That's it. You got to love it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Eventually, there will be a GOP debate where Governor Rick Perry is called out by a moderator for knowingly lying about the impact of the first stimulus on his state.
He had $800 billion worth of stimulus in the first round of stimulus. It created zero jobs.
That was the Texas governor responding to a question about jobs creation during the CNN Tea Party GOP debate on Monday. Moderator Wolf Blitzer failed to challenge the presidential candidate by presenting him with key facts. For one, Perry constantly touts his ability to create jobs while failing to address how many of those jobs were created or saved by President Barack Obama's first stimulus plan. The Houston Chronicle reported in July of 2010 that Perry was the beneficiary of more than 47,000 jobs, thanks to $17.4 billion in stimulus money he accepted from the federal government. In Houston alone, the stimulus dollars triggered 960 contracts, grants, and loans. The Congressional Budget Office also strongly disagrees with Perry's constant trumpeting that the stimulus didn't create any jobs. In the most recent report available from the nonpartisan organization, it found that anywhere from 1 million to 2.9 million jobs could likely be attributed to Obama's stimulus plan. It also credits the Recovery Act with reducing the unemployment rate by 0.5% to 1.6%.
I support a personal retirement account option in order to phase off the current system. We know that this works. It worked in the small country of Chile when they did it 30 years ago.
That was Godfather Pizza CEO and Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain touting Chile's privatized Social Security plan during the New Hampshire debate. It's a plan he's brought up in every debate since. What Cain fails to acknowledge in his comments is that Chile's system mandates that every worker must contribute 10% of earnings into a government-approved and regulated pension fund administration company. The government regulations are in place to ensure the PFAs provide a low-risk portfolio. One additional way the government isn't completely out of the picture is in making sure the system doesn't collapse due to individuals who couldn't make the minimum monthly payments. The government has a program that subsidizes low-wage earners when they reach retirement, costing the Chilean government $66 billion as of 2005. The system is in some ways similar to the Affordable Health Care Act, which Herman Cain is opposed to. That act mandates that U.S. citizens purchase minimal essential health care coverage. If they don't buy the coverage, an individual without insurance could be fined 2.5% of household income.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Now, it's back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
I got 800 miles of open border right outside my door. There's Minutemen in little pickup trucks who declared their own dang war. Now the government wants to build a barrier like old Berlin, 8 feet tall. But if Uncle Sam sends the illegals home, who's gonna build the wall? Who's gonna build your wall, boy?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So the radical right-wing wrecking crew is on this all-out crazy mode thing. It's really scary to watch them try to radicalize the other. I mean, to out-radicalize each other. It's amazing to me. In Michigan, for instance, there are five Republicans doing the one-upsmanship thing. They're trying to unseat Debbie Stabenow, the Democratic senator there. And you got this businessman, Peter Konechny, probably the winner of the one-upsmanship award. He says he supports capping the number of Muslims allowed in the country. So we can only have so many Muslims allowed to come into the country. That's it. And I'm kind of waiting for that to morph into them. We should only allow so many of them to live in each town and so many of them to live on each street. And maybe there has to be a house between them. Some real craziness. And I guess if Daryl Metcalf here in the state of Pennsylvania gets a hold of that, maybe we will see legislation. But it's just nuts. I mean, we're spending time talking about English-only legislation here in the state. Anyway, here to help us go through some of this, some of these really bad bills, is our good friend attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at these two bills, Rosemary Schwanger's bill, 361, and Scott Perry's 888, identical bills, with maybe a word changed here or there. So I'm gotta wonder which one of them or neither of them wrote it. But the Commonwealth should be an English only place.
Yeah, well, you know, tell it to all of the ancestors of those of us who came to this country from Asia, from Eastern Europe, from Western Europe, from South America, from Central America. You know, the people that they decided had to come here to work for below standard wages and be exploited. It was okay, and it's amazing to me. It's breathtaking because sometimes when I listen to Schwanger and Perry speak, it's as if they're not speaking English.
Yeah. You know, the question I guess I have is English really in danger of extinction? I mean, are we that close to losing our culture that we've now got to resort to some kind of draconian piece of legislation? That I don't even know how you really make an argument for.
Well, I think that what you have happen is that when somebody goes to the grocery store and buys a quart of milk and a loaf of bread to feed their children, if they don't speak English, you have them arrested on the spot. I mean, that's the only thing that's fair and logical. When we live in a country and we live in a state and we live in a community that has been devastated by a flood, rocked by an earthquake, overwhelmed by a hurricane, with 9 or 10% counted unemployment and 17 or 18% actual unemployment, and even higher for people of color, for young people, for women. Why in the world these people are investing their time and our very precious tax dollars that pay them and their staffs and for their office space to play with this jingoistic junk.
Well,
it's so far beyond me that I have difficulty, Rick, describing.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's they have no plan on how to fix the real problem, so they need the distraction. They need the diversion to make it to rile people up and get people all twisted in the panties so that they're distracted away from what's not happening, which is creating jobs, which is not happening, which is helping people.
Well, you know what? Clearly they don't have a plan, but more importantly, they're not even thinking about a plan. What they're thinking about instead is, as you say, getting people's knickers in a twist about something that doesn't count because they don't want to deal with the things that do count. You know, if they would just stop being the handmaidens of their corporate sponsors, you know, the people who want to buy the wine and spirit shops out from under us for pennies on a dollar, the people who want to steal tax dollars and use them to privatize education access, maybe, just maybe, together, working as a team, recognizing that this is a nation of immigrants and the children of immigrants, we could start to peel the onion of our real problems. We have in central Pennsylvania, up and down the Susquehanna River Valley, a whole slew of towns and communities that need to be rebuilt now because a week ago they were underwater, literally underwater. And that was in addition to and on top of the whacks and slashes that they've been subjected to in budget cuts and education funding cuts and inability to pay bond debt and, you know, you name it, the list goes on and on. You articulate it far better than I. And here we are in this jingoistic junk, as I call it, of, you know, let's tell people that we'll solve their problems. We'll get to the heart of this after we have exploited a generation of people by hauling them in here and encouraging their employers to allow them to work under the table and under the radar. Now that they're here, we're going to punish them for failing to learn the language that the majority of us speak because we don't allow them to have educational access to allow them to learn the language.
Or the time. I mean, English is not an easy language to learn. It takes some time.
Well, you know, apparently it takes a great deal of time because neither Schwanger nor Perry speak the English that I know. And here we are.
There you go. You know, here's the thing. I'm taking my daughter to New York this weekend. A friend is having a birthday party at the zoo, and I'm going to take my daughter to the Statue of Liberty. And, you know, I look at these two pieces of legislation and I go, you know, how can I take my daughter to the statue? And where it's inscribed, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses.
Yeah, Emma Lazarus must be spinning. You're right.
You know, how do I take my daughter to that and say, you know, this is what the country's based on. This is your country, and then come back to our state and have someone like Perry or Schwanger, doing these things.
Well, it is a very fair and legitimate observation you make. And of all places, you know, New York, and not just New York, Philadelphia, here in Harrisburg. We grew up in a generation where we were taught about America being a melting pot, and the Scott Perrys and Rosemary Schwangers of the world want to introduce legislation, and not them. I mean, they're just
they're the tools,
the ball carriers, if you will,
yeah.
For, you know,
I'm trying to find out if this bill is part of Alec's bills.
Oh, I it's very clearly part of the Alec program, and that's just what I was about to say. I was searching for the name, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as Alec, which is the agent provocateur, funded, of course, by the Koch brothers and other wing nuts. And, you know, collecting dues from the likes of people like Representative Terzai, the majority leader of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, who is using tax dollars to pay for his affiliation with ALEC in order to get the canned legislation that ALEC is advocating in every state. These are the same people that brought you Wisconsin, that brought you Michigan, that brought you Indiana, that brought you Ohio, that brought you Kentucky. And they're spewing their illegitimate, you know, inconsistent, unbelievable poison here in Pennsylvania, not just with or even primarily with this English First garbage, but also with things like voter suppression laws that they call voter identification, and with proposed statutes to rearrange and reallocate how we elect the President of the United States from here in Pennsylvania, cast our votes, even as we are losing our voice because of the loss of population, reapportioning congressional seats away from Pennsylvania and down to Florida and in Texas.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because Senate Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi says he's intending to introduce some legislation really that is going to fundamentally change this Commonwealth, change how we allocate the electors. And, you know, I thought that, you know, they believed in institution, they believe in the Constitution, they believe in the country, and radical wrecking ball change.
Well, they're doing something that shocks the conscience of even what they say. They are the agent provocateur, first and foremost, of the idea that in a democracy, in a republic like ours, majority rules. And what Senator Pileggi's legislation, as I understand it, would do is say that majority doesn't rule, that the majority gets a voice and the minority gets a vote in the Electoral College from Pennsylvania's electors, so that somehow or another, if they can't win the elections fair and square, they want to be able to rig them.
And that brings me to House Bill 934, which passed back in June, 108-88, with all the Republicans for it, Democrats against it. The voter ID bill that passed on third consideration now in the Senate.
Right, you got to change your vernacular, buddy. You got to change the way you talk about that. That's not the voter ID bill.
Well, that's what it's titled.
It's what it's titled may be voter ID, but what it is voter suppression. It's the voter suppression law of 2011, and it's sponsored by a host of right-wing ding-a-lings. But this is voter suppression, voter exclusion. This is all aimed at, stop the silliness here. This is all aimed at disenfranchising, stripping poor people, indigent people, aged people, students, of their right to vote, because it says that if you don't have a valid driver's license, then you have to go to the state's driver's license bureau in order to get a voter permissible state ID. Okay, the last country that did this, of course, was the former Soviet Union. We decried it in those days because it was Big Brother watching us. But now we're going to say to the 82-year-old great-grandmother who no longer drives and doesn't keep an active driver's license that she's going to have to find her way to the Voter License Bureau in order to get a voter ID card if she wants to vote, even though she has voted consistently year in and year out in primaries and general elections for well over 62 consecutive years. Give me a break.
Yeah, well, you know what it's about. It's about disenfranchising the poor and the elderly. And it's, and what the thing that upsets me beyond
it's about
that,
disenfranchising a demograph who are loyal Americans, who are good citizens, who are extraordinary Pennsylvanians, and who happen to tend to vote Democratic. Statistically.
Yeah, well, I mean, have we not been paying attention to every election since George Bush was appointed president in 2000? They have done everything they can do, and in fact, I think it was Paul Weyrich who said it, you know, our power goes up as the electorate goes down. If you can hold down the vote, they got a better chance of winning.
Yeah, well, and for them, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. they tell us that we have, you know, once again, we're not talking about jobs here. We're not talking about putting people to work. But they tell us that we have a huge problem in this country of people fraudulently casting votes and impersonating somebody else because we don't have adequate voter identification. You want a statistic, Rick? I'll give you one. Do you know that today it is 8 times more likely that you will get struck by a bolt of lightning than it is that somebody improperly identifies themselves in a voting booth?
I believe that. I think, what has it been in the last 10 years? Have been 4 cases?
Exactly 4 cases in the United States, not 4 cases in Pennsylvania. Okay, not 4 cases in Wisconsin, which was the original state to pass the poison. But 4 cases in the United States of America.
Oh, but Irwin, what about Acorn? All that voter fraud that went on with Acorn.
The only thing that was fraudulent about Acorn wasn't the voter fraud. It was the guy who made the fraudulent movie who also made a fraudulent movie about an employee of the United States Department of Agriculture. Okay, let's get real here. There is a fraud going on, but it has nothing to do with voter identification.
So in getting to this bill, I mean, it's in the Senate right now. Any chance of this getting through the Senate? I mean,
I think that very clearly there's a chance. I mean, remember, these are from the people, Alec, okay, who brought you union busting in Wisconsin, who brought you stripping people of a voice at work in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Michigan, in Kentucky. We get voter ID proposals. We get congressional redistricting proposals. We get, imagine the thought, disenfranchisement of the Electoral College proposals. Okay, so, yes, I think that there's a real and meaningful chance, and His Honor, the governor of Pennsylvania, has indicated a favorable take on things like voter ID and on Senator Pileggi's proposal to reallocate, realign, and do away with more than 2 centuries of Pennsylvania tolerance in history in changing the way the Pennsylvania Electoral College casts its vote for the presidency of the United States of America.
Amazing stuff. So, and that's why we need an active, informed electorate, and we need people to get out and vote. And every time I talk about voting, I remember my high school civics teacher. He said, you know, don't bother voting. It makes my vote that much powerful. I mean, he was being facetious. Mm-hmm. And it goes with this Paul Wayward clip that I play quite often because I think it's extremely important.
Oh,
many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And I don't think you can lay it out any better than that.
Well, you can't lay it out any more strongly than that, but you know what? That sounds shockingly, like speeches that have been translated from the German from the National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party in Germany in the 1930s.
And that's what scares me. Irwin, always great talking with you. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
You bet, brother.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's bedtime, children. Get on your jammies, scooch under the covers, and I'll tell you another fairy tale. In this one, Prince Rick is trying to make it to the big White House in Washington. It's a strange quest because he calls the capital city, quote, a seedy place. And he tells the commoners in the land that he hates, nay, deeply loathes, the very government that he wants to head. With his Tea Party hat carefully positioned atop his bounteous crop of perfectly coiffed hair, Prince Rick warns the commoners that big government is bad, 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 because it intrudes into their lives, forcing things like Social Security and Medicare on them. Strangest of all, though, this prancing prince of privilege would not be where he is without the steady intrusion of big government into his life. From first grade through college, his education was paid for by local, state, and federal taxpayers. Also, as cotton farmers, he and his family were supported with thousands of dollars in crop subsidies from the pockets of national taxpayers. Then, after a brief stint as a government-paid Air Force transport pilot, the perfidious prince hit the mother lode of government largesse, political office, where he's been for 27 years and counting. In addition to drawing more than a quarter century's worth of monthly paychecks from Texas taxpayers, Prince Rick also receives full health coverage and a generous pension benefit from the state, plus $10,000 a month to rent a luxury home, a flock of personal aides, and even a state-paid subscription to Food and Wine magazine. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, children, the moral of this fairy tale is to ignore the prince's hypocritical hype and look at what he actually does. When Rick Perry says he intends to make government, quote, as inconsequential as possible, what he means is in your life, not in his.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So today the president was in North Carolina taking his job message to North Carolina State University. And, you know, the college kids, those are the ones who are, I got to be honest, they've got to be the ones looking at the future going, do something with the default rate, with the unemployment rate, like we were talking about yesterday, the kids getting out of Ivy League schools working at restaurants and, you know, cutting grass for a living. Amazing stuff. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Eric on line one. How you doing tonight, Eric?
Good. Rick, I've been a long-time listener, and I haven't really had a chance to call in before, but I've been listening to you on the Stitcher app for quite a while now.
I appreciate it.
No problem. Well, I just want to let you know that I work at FIA, and they monitor pretty much everything we do over there, which is kind of accepted with the whole fact that it is a federal, you know, student loan.
Right.
Today came up a situation when I had to go to my steward, which of course didn't get back to me because we are unionized over there. But we were doing work in between phone calls. The way that this works is they're asking us to do more work for the same amount with no raise up to when, you know, Governor Corbett decides that he wants to give the state workers more money again. So we're really actually doing two jobs at one time and not getting the actual benefit out of it. So it's one of those things where you were talking about before many times of how we're working twice as hard and getting the same amount when it comes to wage, where the corporations continue to ask us to do more and more and more, and we are getting the same amount of money out of it.
Yeah, I mean, so, at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, you guys, you know, filing grievances. You have the union there to go after this. You know, and to be honest, I would be ticked off myself.
It was amazing to me because I'm sitting here talking to one of my my little higher than me, and she said, I understand exactly what you're coming from. I can't do anything because it's all coming from above. And, you know, and I don't blame her for it because she's just doing her job.
Right.
But, you know, it's time and a place. You know what I mean? It's time to stand up and say something. I mean, every time, you know, your music comes on in between the breaks, I start singing along to it because we all have to fight back. And I don't, and one of our workers, you know, I mentioned something to them about it today, and they said, well, you know, nothing's going to happen. You're going to say something, you know, I'm just going to put my head down and do my work. Well, if everyone continues to put their head down, we're going to get less wage and more work to have to be done each week.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's the divide and conquer. As long as they can keep you divided in your cubicles and keep everybody keeps putting their head down and letting the other guy do it, that's what's going on in this country. What's got to happen is, as a group, as the entire unit, you've got to say enough is enough already. We need some help. And what's worrisome to me is, you know, you can keep up that kind of work pace for a while, a year, two, five, whatever, but eventually you burn out.
Absolutely. That's where I've been at. I've been at three different departments throughout my time there. And I, you know, and every time that I get to the point where I'm burnt out, they move me to a different department, which is okay. I mean, it's something new to learn.
Right.
But, you know, I've only been there a few years and I'm already on my third department. So, you know, it's running out of departments to be transferred to.
Well, Eric, keep up the fight, brother, and you got to keep pushing your elected leaders. You got to keep pushing folks to stand up for you. That's the whole point of it.
Thanks so much, Rick, and keep on the fight.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Eric. You look at it. At the end of the day, it's about people standing together and saying enough's enough, man. We're gonna fight back on this. You know, I. Yeah, what's the point of creating a bunch of jobs if they're going to be the kind where you're cracking the whip on people?
Well, what he's talking about is what millions of working people are experiencing.
Yep.
They want you to do more with more in less time. For the same amount of money, of course.
So the earnings for male workers, now since we're talking about jobs and wages, over the last year have been lower than they have been since 1978, according to the census data that was released yesterday, I believe it was, which has showed that the real median income, now lower than it was in 78, but for men, adjusted for inflation, down to 1978 levels. I mean, stop and think about that for a minute. All of the progress we had, all of the productivity gains that have happened for corporate America, just what Eric was talking about. They're doing more, getting less. This is bearing it out. The numbers are what they are. And if you look, they've got some really nice graphs that lay this out. Productivity keeps up. It's on a 45-degree angle, straight across the graph. Productivity used to keep up, or wages used to keep up with productivity. And then it took a nice 90-degree turn. And that was it. And now it's going down. So all that productivity, we're still working more, working harder, working longer, but the gains are not there. And it's something that I think folks need to fight back over. So you looked yesterday, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, they released a report on education trends. And they're saying that the world's wealthiest countries, including the U.S., to the extent to which college education is subsidized by taxpayers, it varies from country to country. And that the U.S., no big surprise, we're down near the bottom. All these other countries are going, you know what, we need to invest in our workforce. We need to invest in our students. We need to invest in education and better skills. Why? Because we want those high-tech jobs. You look at Germany, and Germany is investing in their people wildly. We're the only ones who are talking about cutting education. We're the only ones talking about, cut all those programs for the future. I mean, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you stop and you think about it. And I look at this solar thing with this Solyndra, which they had a hearing today. And the Republicans are going to try and use this to one, destroy alternative energy, and two, go after Obama with. And they're trying to say there's a bunch of emails, there's a bunch of stuff that the White House pressured the Energy Department to give a whole bunch of loan guarantees to this Solyndra, you know, because that would be a groundbreaking event. And the guy who is their director, a guy named Jonathan Silver, said that, we weren't pushed into this. The reality is the rest of the world takes the industry of solar and alternative energy as enormously serious, were his words. He said it's a multi-trillion dollar market that will create tens of thousands of jobs. And, you know, I look at this New York Times piece. One of these prominent investors, one of these hedge fund guys, who said, you know, is solar dead? No, he doesn't think so. Look, a lot of these companies, they're going to try and they're going to fail, and it's going to cost us some money. And he talked about the personal computer market, at which there were at one point 53 makers of personal computers. Now there's just a handful. And I love the quote he came up with. He said, we have this myth that the IT industry got started on its own. He said, don't kid yourself about the lone entrepreneur in the garage creating an industry by themselves. Government had a lot to do with that. A lot of government investment went into the computer, went into the internet. But we have this view, and when I read this article, I immediately thought of HP. Because I remember the commercials on TV of, you know, Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packer in their garage, you know, tinkering and creating a whole, this multinational global corporation out of their little one-car garage. What they don't tell you is they started that small business back in the 30s. And they were making little light bulbs, and they were making little doodads and whatnots, and it took them years and massive amounts of government subsidies to become, well, HP. You know, it wasn't overnight, as some wanted to portray it. It wasn't, you know, these guys who just said, oh, well, we're going to be able to do this. Had nothing. That's not how it worked. We invested in those companies, and wildly, with huge amounts of money. And, you know, I look at the solar thing. And maybe they're right. Maybe we shouldn't have given them loan guarantees. In fact, I think there was somebody who said we shouldn't do that. We should buy them. And I look at this CNN story today that points out this strong solar corporation. They have launched this project, a $1 billion project, to double the number of residential photovoltaic systems in the nation. They're going to install rooftop solar arrays on 160,000 homes and buildings and community centers and administrative buildings. So what the government has done, said, okay, there are military bases all across the country. There are 124 of these military housing developments that are going on right now in 33 states. And what the Department of Energy said, okay, go ahead. We'll give you $344 million loan once they're installed. We'll give you the money once you get things up and running. Once those solar panels are in place, we'll give you the money. And I sit back and I go, you know, I think there was someone who said that was a good idea. Oh, yeah, me. Instead of here, start up a company, say, here's the demand. Here's what we need. Every military house in this country, everything on a military base, solar panels. And what's amazing to me, and this is what some people don't know, is that the Department of Defense is the largest consumer of electricity in the world. And this project is going to add about 371 megawatts of solar capacity. That is enormous. It's going to help them reach their goal of 25% of alternative energy needs by 2025. Smart, but try and get a Republican to buy into that, man. It's just nuts. And I look at my solar panels, very happy with them. You know, I've saved some 3,200 cubic feet of carbon going into the atmosphere. I'm, you know, every day I go and I look at the thing. This is how much I've saved. This is how much I've generated. It's cut my bill by almost 35%.
And you're forgetting what they did at the Carlisle School. Classic example. I would like to know the numbers in a couple of years, what they've saved a taxpayer.
Yep. And it's going to be there for a generation at least. And that's the forward thinking that we used to have. Not much anymore. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quick break, right back after this.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. There, right there, the beginning of the class war. The first shot fired across the CEO boardroom, allowing corporate America, giving them the signal. Go on, boys. Take it all back. Take back that middle class existence. Go get that health care back. Go get those pensions back. Go get those wage increases back. Go get it. Go on. And what have we done since? Well, not fight back. And I look at what's going on in Britain right now. They're about to, they're going to have a vote on whether they should have a general strike. It will be the biggest industrial action since the Great Strike of 1926. And why are they doing it? Because they're talking about changing their pensions, lowering their pensions, taking money away from them at a time where everyone realizes over there who screwed them. I think the problem here is the moneyed interests in the media. See, over there, newspapers and the media isn't as controlled as it is here. When you buy a newspaper there, it's actually a couple of bucks. So it better be a pretty good newspaper. And it better have some real investigative journalism. It better say something. It better not just be infotainment and, hey, the runaway bride ran away, or this girl ran down the street. It better be some actual freaking news. And it better be something we can use. But here in this country, we need our infotainment. We need to be entertained instead of informed. So when they start talking about raising the retirement age and cutting the benefits, people there go, wait a minute. We know who backed the Brinks truck up to the bank and stole all the money. We know where it is. Here in this country, we've been led to believe, well, yes, it's those workers, it's those greedy workers who want pensions. What, they want health care too? What else they want? They want sick days? How dare they? That seems to be the idea here. But over there across the pond, a little bit more informed, a little bit more up on how the economy collapsed and who crashed it and where that money is, because they know it's not in their pockets. And those folks, they go out in the streets. When they're not happy, to the streets. which is, I think, something we need to kind of look at. You know, back on this day in 1959, Congress passed the Landrum-Griffith Act, expanding a lot of the really anti-labor, ugly provisions of Taft-Hartley, and increased the union reporting requirements, also restricted secondary boycotts and secondary boycott picketing. So, you know, here again, restricting the rights of workers, restricting the rights of people to take to the streets. Nice, huh? So what happened also today, it's kind of fitting that you look at Landrum-Griffith and you go, you know, ugly anti-union bill passed through Congress. So what did Congress do today? Well, the Republicans in the Senate, they pushed through their anti-NLRB bill, the one that, you know, making Boeing basically letting them off the hook. It's the Protecting Boeing from Actually Having to Follow the Law Act, which they're calling some nonsense, you know, the Protecting Americans from you know, blah, 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 from jobs being taken away because they're bad. And again, it's one of these things where, you know, bought, paid for. And it's interesting who put this forth. The senators from South Carolina, no real surprise there. The senators from Wyoming, no real surprise there. A senator from Kentucky, no surprise there. A senator from Tennessee, no surprise there. Oddly enough, all right-to-work states. Kind of makes you wonder. But the thing is they're going to push this forward. And what I love about that piece of legislation is it's retroactive. So I wish I had the power, and I said this last night, I wish I had the power to break the law and then hire someone to go back and change the law retroactively so that what I did was not wrong, that it was right, and it was a good thing. And in fact, maybe give me the Congressional Medal of Freedom. Maybe the CEO of Boeing, once they go and they change this retroactively, maybe they'll hold him up on a pedestal and the next president, if it's a Republican, will give him, like Bush would do, would give him the Congressional Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor the country has. Why? Well, because he stuck it to those working people. And I look at the op-ed in the Detroit newspaper today. And Jimmy Hoffa's got a good piece in there, and I think it's worth taking a look at. It's titled, Union Fight Against GOP Will Continue. And he says, look, these rich corporations are outsourcing our jobs, been doing it for a long time. They're demanding these massive concessions just because they can get it, just because they can. And you look at all of these politicians who are bought and paid for by the corporations, given all this lip service about, oh, we need shared sacrifice and we need to tighten our belts, except they don't ask them for anything. It's all whenever there's shared sacrifice, it's you and me. See, shared sacrifice means you poor working stiff, sorry, you're out of luck. And and Hoffa says, look, you know, all these public sector jobs being cut, all these collective bargaining rights being taken away, this is nothing more then one more way to pay for those corporate handouts. You want to talk about redistribution of wealth? Right here, man. They are stealing. I mean, it's the reverse Robin Hood. We're stealing from the poor to give to the rich. But do you think, and what's frustrating to me is that you have very few voices out there, especially in Washington, who are going to yell from the highest mountain and carry on and kick and scream. And I'm frustrated over it. And you look at this Chamber of Commerce thing that they're doing. They're running radio ads, trying to pass this stealing of rights. And they're spending millions of dollars to do it. It's just nuts. We're right back after this. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Eventually, there will be a GOP debate where Governor Rick Perry is called out by a moderator for knowingly lying about the impact of the first stimulus on his state.
He had $800 billion worth of stimulus in the first round of stimulus. It created zero jobs.
That was the Texas governor responding to a question about jobs creation during the CNN Tea Party GOP debate on Monday. Moderator Wolf Blitzer failed to challenge the presidential candidate by presenting him with key facts. For one, Perry constantly touts his ability to create jobs while failing to address how many of those jobs were created or saved by President Barack Obama's first stimulus plan. The Houston Chronicle reported in July of 2010 that Perry was the beneficiary of more than 47,000 jobs thanks to $17.4 billion in stimulus money he accepted from the federal government. In Houston alone, the stimulus dollars triggered 960 contracts, grants, and loans. The Congressional Budget Office also strongly disagrees with Perry's constant trumpeting that the stimulus didn't create any jobs. In the most recent report available from the nonpartisan organization, it found that anywhere from 1 million to 2.9 million jobs could likely be attributed to Obama's stimulus plan. It also credits the Recovery Act with reducing the unemployment rate by 0.5% to 1.6%.
I support a personal retirement account option in order to phase off the current system. We know that this works. It worked in the small country of Chile when they did it 30 years ago.
That was Godfather Pizza CEO and Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain touting Chile's privatized Social Security plan during the New Hampshire debate. It's a plan he's brought up in every debate since. What Cain fails to acknowledge in his comments is that Chile's system mandates that every worker must contribute 10% of earnings into a government-approved and regulated pension fund administration company. The government regulations are in place to ensure the PFAs provide a low-risk portfolio. One additional way the government isn't completely out of the picture is in making sure the system doesn't collapse due to individuals who couldn't make the minimum monthly payments. The government has a program that subsidizes low-wage earners when they reach retirement, costing the Chilean government $66 billion as of 2005. The system is in some ways similar to the Affordable Health Care Act, which Herman Cain is opposed to. That act mandates that U.S. citizens purchase minimal essential health care coverage. If they don't buy the coverage, an individual without insurance could be fined 2.5% of household income.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there, or get, if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app and look for the, and take the program with you. So last night we were talking about the guy at Carlisle who was arrested for eating $25 worth of raw meat at the local Walmart. And what gets me, he's arrested and he was charged with a felony. Evidently it was his fourth retail theft arrest, and now for $25 worth of raw meat, it'll probably cost us tens of thousands of dollars to incarcerate the guy. And you look at the prison industrial complex in this nation, and they've done a masterful job pushing for longer sentences, harsher mandatory sentences, you know, because we gotta keep us law-abiding folk free of those raw meat-eating evil scourges. But the question is why and who profits? Big money in this industry. That's why I've asked Ernest Drucker. He's the author of A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. Ernest, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be there.
I look at this, and I look at this guy, you know, walked into a Walmart, picked up a couple of pinches of meat, and was eating raw meat in the aisle. He's probably going to do some serious jail time over that.
Yeah, a year a pound.
Probably. And, you know, I ask the question, is justice best served by putting this guy in jail?
Well, it's not about justice. It's about punishment.
Excellent point. And, you know, who profits from the punishment? I look at the story in Ohio as we're privatizing our prisons and profitizing them. I think that's pretty much the plague of our prison system.
Well, in a way, it is it's the engine that keeps it going. The motives behind the people, you know, it's just another industry. But unlike a lot of other industries, even those that produce useless products, this one actually does great harm to the people that it handles. It's almost like, I'm an epidemiologist, which means I look at the way in which large populations are affected by new diseases. I work in AIDS research, for example.
Right.
And this prison phenomenon, is what we're saying, which is unprecedented in this country's history, is this huge disaster for really close to 10 million people now who have been run through this system. And as though you were dipped in some poison and then sent back home. There's a book by, I work at John Jay College in New York, and the president of college, Jeremy Travis, has a book called But They All Come Home. And that's interesting because the reality is that it's not like you're taking people. They could be the baddest people in the world, and you're getting rid of them. That's the image they create. But in reality, what they do is they take them into a system that removes any possibility they may have of having a life in the future. Very indiscriminating, and lets them know it in no mean terms, and then puts them back in the same families, the same communities they came from, in very, very large numbers. So it's a concentrated phenomenon. And that poisons the social network that especially poor people and working poor people depend on.
And what you've ended up doing is you've ended up creating a system where they're automatically going to go back. And, you know, I've known a couple of people who've been in prison, and they tell the same story. They've got, like, the one guy said, I've got a stink on me. Nobody's ever going to hire me. I'm now, my life is basically committing another crime to go back to jail.
But that's the only occupational category open to you.
And this guy said, you know, they're overcrowded. And you look at the statistics, we have locked up more people than any country in the world by any metrics. And I asked the question, do we have that many really bad people who need to be locked up more than everybody else in the world?
Well, yeah, but a lot of them in government, so they're covered.
But the sad thing is they generally don't go to the kind of prisons that my friend went to.
No, they don't. They don't. It's a catastrophe, really. And the idea that it's promoted as a social good, it breaks my heart.
So I look at the cover of your book, and I got to tell you, you know, you look at this, it's a really an amazing picture of just people crammed, warehoused, was my first thought, crammed into this room, warehoused, like, you know, just like any product.
Well, or, you know, a little reminiscent of concentration camps.
So when did this all start? I mean, your background is in AIDS research and epidemiology. So you go back, and as I understand it, to look for where it happened. And I think the Snow was his name.
Right.
Where did this all start? I mean, he came up with the pump, and I forget.
Oh, okay. The book begins with kind of epidemiology 101, but most people don't know what epidemiology means. It's an intimidating word. A lot of people used to think I worked in skin disease. But really, what it means, it's interesting, what it is, epi is upon, and demos the people. This is something upon the people, a plague upon the people. And yet it's promoted as promoting public safety for the good. You can get elected to office if you're for it.
Right.
And you can get shot down if you're against it. And you know, there have always been prisons. There have always been people who broke the law. There have always been people who, you know, got punished, people who punished them. Nothing new under the sun. But the magnitude of it, like the difference between, you know, a case of the flu and cancer, or a case of the flu and a flu epidemic, they're quite different things. And as an epidemiologist, I'm concerned with what promotes and propagates it, what keeps it going. How does it, you know, the idea that something like incarceration would be catching is a strange idea on the face of it. But so with the idea, I see you've been in labor union work, as I was many years ago, in occupational health. And we had guys who worked in asbestos factories. And they bring the asbestos home when they close.
Right.
And the kids got cancer from it. So you have a situation where you create a massive, think of it as a toxic exposure. For really, at this point, close to 10 million people in the course of this explosion, which began in the 70s with the passage of mandatory drug sentencing. You know, it's not that drugs aren't a problem. I ran a drug program for 20 years, so I know what kind of problems drugs cause. But
well, we have a different
kind of problems that being incarcerated can cause, getting a criminal record can cause. If your drug problem has something to do with your self-esteem and you need to build that up to to be able to get free of drugs. This is not doing it. It's doing just the reverse. It systematically cripples people.
Yeah, so when did we, I don't know if we ever did look at drug abuse as a health issue, but when did we really look at it as a criminal issue? I remember reading as a kid, you know, the Sherlock Holmes novels. And as I remember, Sherlock Holmes was a cocaine and opium freak, who by today's standards would be locked up for quite some time.
I guess what's the question though?
Well, the question is when did it turn from being a a health issue to being an actual crime?
Well, you know, the health issue part of it is kind of fraudulent. So within, you know, we have these manuals called diagnostic statistical manuals in mental health and in medicine that names the diseases and describes them. It's like an encyclopedic, and it's the authority. And, these are full of international classification of diseases, something the entire world uses to classify different conditions. And so, you know, on the alcoholism, everyone now agrees alcoholism is a disease. Drug addiction, most people agree it's a disease. So why do you treat a disease by imprisoning people? Well, because the disease is based on the use of drugs, which the world has decided should be illegal. And it turns out, if you look back on that, it's the United States doing, though, about 100 years ago, as they're trying to break into trade in China, the U.S. decided they were going to take the lead in opposing opium. And they were just, you know, kind of shamelessly exploiting the fact that the British were involved in shipping opium into China, so they were going to take the other position, be against opium. It was led by some zealot minister. And it turned out they noticed that this was, over time, that this was a popular political position because people are inherently afraid of demon drugs, their kids becoming addicts, you know, all that stuff. There's a lot of racism behind it historically, you know, the Chinese and their opium dens and the Mexicans with their marijuana and the blacks with their cocaine. Even had a thing in the 1930s where that the police had to carry 45 because 38 guns weren't powerful enough to stop a coked up Negro, unquote.
Wow.
So you have this demonization built up in mythology about what? That's something that people have always done. People have always got intoxicated using this or that. You know, we have the experience of alcohol prohibition, which you think anybody would get the point that you can't treat these things that way, that you got something people do, they do it because they like it. It may harm some of them, but that's true of a lot of things that we do. And therefore, for their own good, you're going to make it illegal. You're going to create this apparatus. Like you said before, this industry is a very famous book called Crime Control is Industry, Toward the New American Gulag. And it says it all. And once something gets established that way, another epidemic feature takes on a life of its own. It fights to perpetuate itself, to expand itself, you know, like businesses do. And corrections and imprisonment to become a huge business, especially in a depressed economic climate where people are on other jobs. People upstate New York, we've closed a lot of prisons in New York. We've reduced the population 20,000 people from 75,000 down to 50,000 in the last 10 years in New York State, partly because of a lot of pushback from various progressive groups, labor unions among them, who became to understand that the money that went into prisons was exactly not going into other things people needed to do.
Right.
And it took effect, especially when Dave Patterson became governor. It was the time he got us sort of over the bar and began to change these mandatory sentencing laws. In the first year of this change of just four statutes from D, C, and D felonies in New York State for nonviolent drug offenders carried mandatory sentences. And people should understand that mandatory sentences doesn't just mean, you know, if you had this much heroin, you get this many years. It means the first time you do it. The second time you get double, third time triple, that sort of thing. Three strikes, you're out kind of thinking. So as they began to roll back those rules, in the first year alone, in New York State alone, we had 1,400 fewer people put in prison. And when you think what prison means for you know, people's lives, especially people who haven't, you know, they're not bank robbers, they're not murderers, they're not rapists. There are certainly people involved in buying and selling drugs. That's what drug users do. But then, you know, no kingpins. There aren't 1,400 drug kingpins in the entire United States. And so by relieving that there's these changing just these four statutes, 1,400 fewer people in prison, that's the equivalent of, 50,000 a year per person. Do the math. It's like...
It's a lot of opportunity to do other things.
That's right.
You know, and I look at this, and to be honest, when the recession hit, I had thought that we would see, I saw California did it, I thought we'd see a lot more of this happening. But as I see states like Ohio moving to a more privatized prison system, the lobbying that goes into this, I see going back up, and I think those rules will then come back. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if they'd be able to get them back. But I do think that they'll find other things to do to punish. Remember, I said it's not about social justice. It's not about justice. It's about punishment. And I think that impulse is a kind of abroad in the land. You know, like I heard this piece of that guy Rick Perry in some debate. I sort of jumped on the Daily Show actually, where Brian Williams, the guy from NBC News, this little straight arrow, asked him. What he thinks about having presided over the execution of 234 people, and he puffs his chest up, and before he can even answer the question, the audience is applauding.
Yep.
And John Stewart pointed out it was the biggest applause line of the night, and a chill goes up my spine when I hear people applauding for mass execution, because that's what it comes down to. The Chinese do this. The Chinese on drug day, they have an annual drug prevention day in the country. And they celebrate it by executing people in stadiums. This is 2009, 2010, now, you know, our Chinese partners. And proudly doing this. They're all drug dealers, you know. But if you look at the details of who these people are, there are about 1,000 people a year executed in the world each year for drug offenses. China, Iran, Indonesia, Malaysia, include Vietnam, a few places. And there's a big movement abroad to try to get them to stop that, because they're also signatories to treaties about human rights that they can't do that without, you know, good reason. And you look at who the people are, their average age in their 20s, they're a lot of them are young women, young men, they're basically smuggling drugs for money. And nope. that gets you executed. The statement that makes about value of life, and then you have this crowd in this audience applauding Perry for executing 200 people.
And you know what scares me about that applause, and Rick Perry as well? Those are the people who would probably, and I know Rick Perry will tell you, and probably the people who applauded, that they're good Christians.
That's right. Well, I'm a good Jew, and it goes against my ethics.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a Christian, and it goes against my ethic.
There you go.
but what the sad reality is they've figured out how to twist whatever their belief is to meet their need, which is imprison people and then leave them there to rot. And then, you know, well, if we happen to kill a few innocent people, like he said, never lost a night's sleep over it.
Well, it's chilling. It really is chilling. And for me, as a Jew, again, it's very reminiscent of the early years of Nazism. Because one of the things that happened there was, you know, the big lie where you could get people scared enough about, in the case of Germany, the Jewish conspiracy, that people who've been quite civilized, you know, Germany is a very civilized country until this time, it produced a lot of very important things, including Social Security. First country to have Social Security, actually, in the 19th century. And suddenly they're crying for blood. And they didn't mean their kids and their brothers' blood, they meant the other. And one of the things, I think part of the, you know, I work around the world a lot, and one of the things about the situation in the United States is you've got the persistence of, you know, the racism that came out of slavery. There's a book by my colleague, Michelle Alexander, who's a law professor down in D.C. She's an African-American woman, wrote a book called The New Jim Crow. It really outlines the kind of continuity between slavery, Jim Crow, and mass incarceration, because the statistics on African Americans in prison and in the criminal justice system is astonishing. You know, the lifetime probability of a young man, a young African American man, being in prison now is over 30%. Washington, D.C., over 90% of all African American men have been in prison.
That's absolutely amazing. Last question I've got for you. I've got to take a break right here. What response have you gotten from the book, from industry, from anyone?
Well, The Economist loved it. Go to the website, plagueofprisons.com, and there's a couple of pieces, some reviews, and The Economist did a really good job. They've had their eye on these drug laws for a long time as profoundly irrational and destructive, and they did a nice job of summarizing the book. If you look at the website, plagueofprisons.com, you can see some of this stuff, but I think, you know, we got to begin to turn our attention. I think think the economics beginning to drive the situation back. Certainly have in a number of places. But others, that industry holds on. California, it has sacrificed the best public school system in the country. They used to have for this immense prison system of 150,000, 160,000 people in it, under federal orders to scale down. And they don't do it. They still don't do it. New governor is not able to do it. The system has a lot of power. There were these drug reform laws out in California, treatment instead of prison. And the Correctional Officers Association successfully lobbied to beat them back. And then they reach out beyond that to the gay marriage bill, for example. They work very actively to beat the gay marriage bill in California.
Right, they get their choice.
There's a political framework this thing is part of that is really evil.
And if they get the choice, they'll probably make being gay a criminal, too, so they can lock them up.
Again, started out criminal in a lot of places.
True. Again, the book is A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. Plagueofprisons.com is the website. We got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Ernest Drucker, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Rick. Nice.
Again, the book, A Plague of Prisons. If you want this book, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, and we will give the first person to email me today a copy of it. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's bedtime, children. Get on your jammies, scooch under the covers, and I'll tell you another Perry tale. In this one, Prince Rick is trying to make it to the big White House in Washington. It's a strange quest because he calls the capital city, quote, a seedy place. And he tells the commoners in the land that he hates, nay, deeply loathes, the very government that he wants to head. With his Tea Party hat carefully positioned atop his bounteous crop of perfectly coiffed hair, Prince Rick warns the commoners that big government is bad, 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 because it intrudes into their lives, forcing things like Social Security and Medicare on them. Strangest of all, though, this prancing prince of privilege would not be where he is without the steady intrusion of big government into his life. From first grade through college, his education was paid for by local, state, and federal taxpayers. Also, as cotton farmers, he and his family were supported with thousands of dollars in crop subsidies from the pockets of national taxpayers. Then, after a brief stint as a government-paid Air Force transport pilot, the perfidious prince hit the mother lode of government largesse, political office, where he's been for 27 years and counting. In addition to drawing more than a quarter century's worth of monthly paychecks from Texas taxpayers, Prince Rick also receives full health coverage and a generous pension benefit from the state, plus $10,000 a month to rent a luxury home, a flock of personal aides, and even a state-paid subscription to Food and Wine magazine. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, children, the moral of this fairy tale is to ignore the prince's hypocritical hype and look at what he actually does. When Rick Perry says he intends to make government, quote, as inconsequential as possible, what he means is in your life, not in his.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, even that last segment, you can download it there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. So, Chaz Bono was on with Ellen DeGeneres talking about his appearance on Dancing with the Stars. And Cher was like, hey, you know, if you've got this much extra time, you've got this extra hostility, she says, I don't know that I can help say anything that's going to make you change your mind or your feelings. She went on to say that, you know, such feelings of hostility and fear, you know, something wrong about that. And she, talking to the kid, you know, what you're doing, you're doing this dance is about as scary as you making the change. Because Chaz Bono was a woman. Now she turned into a man, so he is now a he. And a really, not a very good looking man, sorry to say. I figure if you're going to have the surgery to be a man, maybe have the stomach thing to make you a skinny man, not a big fat man like me. And I look at, you know, these crazy people, these folks at the American Family Association, they're saying that they can't let their children watch. Oh, we just can't let little Susie and Johnny watch. What would we tell them? Well, you would tell them there's a big fat guy dancing on TV with a woman. That's what you would tell them. I mean, it would be like if I were on TV and I was dancing. I would hope someone would ask if I was on fire first, because that's generally the only way I dance. But so there's a big fat guy on TV, and he's dancing poorly. I mean, the real question here is why are you watching Dancing with the Stars? That confuses kids. Jeez, oh, man, get a life, you retards. Oh, I tell you, it's kind of nuts. I mean, people who can't dance, dancing with people who can and bringing them down. Stop it. Stop with these idiotic reality shows, please. And I'm so tired of these sanctimonious religious zealots telling me, oh, it's the gay people who caused the storms, and it's the gay people who caused the earthquake, and, oh, what are we going to tell the children? Don't tell them anything. Let them be children. Stop abusing your kids by focusing their attention on things they don't need to know about until they're older. You know who in the Republican Party's got the right idea? Clint Eastwood. In fact, he did an interview for GQ magazine. I guess it'll be out in October. And he said, you know, I don't give a flying F if gays marry. Could care less. He goes, I don't care who marries who. He goes, you know, why make a big deal out of something that we shouldn't be making a big deal with? He says, you know, they go on and on with this BS about sanctity. He said, don't give me this sanctity crap. Just get everybody a chance to live the life that they want, which is amazing. That the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, who preach that libertarianism to a degree, aren't saying, hey, let the queers marry. Because we've done such a wonderful job with our marriage. Sanctity. And I like Clint Eastwood, love his movies. He describes himself as not a conservative. He's backed some Democrats in the past. He says, you know, more of an Eisenhower Republican. He said, I wanted Eisenhower because he was going to get us out of Korea. Good thing. And he said, you know, I liked the Republican philosophy then. Then they lost it. And libertarians had more of it, he said, but, you know, they've gone a little nuts. And, you know, I go back to this. What do we tell the children? Oh, the children. Oh, their poor, innocent lives. What are we going to tell them? We can let them watch people killing each other on TV. But, you know, two women holding hands walking down the street, that's just going to blow their little minds. I am so sick of that. I'm just so sick of, what about the children? Well, you want to care about the kids? Do what the Smith household does. Turn off the TV. Don't be dumb and watch Dancing with the Stars or any of those other bizarre reality shows who are just trying to get attention. You know, why is no one asking what we're telling our children about these deadbeat dads like this T-twit Congressman Joe Walsh? What are we going to tell those children who can't eat? What are we going to tell his kids who he owes over $100,000 to and is fighting the mother? What are we going to tell those kids? Oh, the poor children. What are we going to tell them? Sorry, you can't have new shoes because daddy's a deadbeat. That's what you tell them. Good thing today, though, Chicago judge ordered that T-twit Congressman Joe Walsh explain why he's $100,000 behind in his child support. And when asked, because evidently his lawyer was the only one who showed up to court, and when asked, she asked the lawyer, where's your client? Well, he's a congressman. He's in Washington. And she said, that's no excuse. That's no excuse. He's no different than anybody else. In fact, if I were the judge, I would say I hold him to a higher account because he is a congressman and a scumbag at that.
And I guess the question is, can she order him to appear? Can she hold him in contempt?
Sure she can.
Oh, I would love to see that.
What I'd love to see her do, honestly, order him to pay his bill. Order him to say, you owe your kid $120,000. Pay it. You got a $175,000 a year job. Start paying. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Reverend C.J. Hawking, Executive Director of Arise Chicago, about the Hyatt strike going on across the country. Right back after this.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
With the PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
I am 60 years old. I was born in 1951. I went through the civil rights there, and I'm telling you, I'm still here. And if I can stand, you can stand and keep standing.
Well, right now, right now,
oh, you know, that's the voice of one of the striking workers saying, you know what? I can stand, you can stand, we're going to fight back. You got to give them credit. You know, I've walked a picket line in my life a number of times. And it takes a special something to go out and say, you know what, I'm going to stand on this line and I'm going to make sure that my voice is heard and we're going to stand up and fight together to accomplish a common goal. And I give these folks, these Hyatt workers, all the credit in the world. They're striking, I guess for a week, struck six locations in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Honolulu. It came to an end today. So let's talk to Reverend C.J. Hawking, Executive Director of Arise Chicago, about what happened today. Reverend Hawking, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, my pleasure to be with you.
So tell me, this week-long strike, what pushed it to this point?
Well, if I could just give a little bit of background on what brought the workers to this very drastic measure to go out on strike. It obviously isn't an action that people take lightly. Back in 2009, the Hyatt fired 100 workers at Boston hotels and replaced them with minimum wage workers. From here, Hyatt proceeded to do an anti-union campaign, including towns of Indianapolis, San Antonio, Santa Clara, where there was no union, but the Hyatt was insisting on the workers not being allowed a fair process towards having a union. you know, these are very dangerous jobs. We don't think of it that way. You know, you kind of nod to the housekeeping staff as you walk by them in a hotel hallway. But in some cities, Indianapolis, for instance, these workers were having to make up 30 rooms a day.
30 rooms? I have a hard time keeping one room clean.
So do my kids. So the standard at the Hilton is 12 or 13 rooms. The Hyatt workers in Chicago used to do 13 rooms a day, and then they got pushed up to 16 rooms a day. So, you know, with this back-breaking work, people have injuries, and they have now bad hearts and knees and arms. And so the workers felt as if they needed to make a stand not only for themselves, but for those who were working in non-union hotels. Religious leaders got together, including especially the Jewish community, in the summer of 2009. You may know that the Pritzker family, very prominent family also in the Obama campaign, owns the Hyatt Hotels. They're a Jewish family, and they reside here in Chicago. And religious leaders, beginning in summer of 2009, started approaching the Pritzker family saying, could we talk about this? We want to make sure that you realize that the way in which you're treating your workers is not in keeping with Jewish values and traditions. Well, they refused, and by fall of 2009, over 200 of us sat in the street and did nonviolent civil disobedience to draw further attention to this. Then in the summer of the following year, 2010, we went to the shareholders meeting. We had over 100 religious leaders singing psalms of liberation and justice outside of the shareholders meeting. We caused quite a ruckus. From there, we were also in the lobby singing and praying as well. So the religious community has also been standing with the workers over these past 2 years. And then today, when they decided to go out on strike, the religious community in Chicago came out to show some very strong support for these workers.
And on the picket line, what kind of support did you see from the community?
Well, it's been an amazing week. First of all, these workers are so inspiring, and it's humbling to any of the rest of us who go home at night and have warm beds and a decent meal to eat. They are laying everything on the line for themselves, for their children, for their grandchildren, and also for people today who are falling into poverty at exponential rates. These workers have decided that they're going to try and hold the line for middle-class jobs in America. These should be good-paying jobs.
Absolutely. I mean, you clean 30 rooms in a day, which I think is extremely excessive, but that's a lot. I mean, that's an awful lot.
It truly is, and some people have told me it's just physically impossible. So for those of us who check into hotel rooms, we might want to do a little extra looking around, because it is just humanly impossible to clean 30 rooms.
And that, I guess, would be the other question. You know, what happens, you know, to do 30 rooms in a day? I mean, you've got to just be doing the bare minimums
right.
at best. And what kind of, you know, hygiene and what kind of cleanliness are we talking about in a Hyatt hotel, which is supposed to be, you know, as my way of thinking, one of the upper echelon hotels?
Absolutely, and I think you raise a great point here, Brett. Starwood and Hilton, two of the three major hotel chains, Hyatt being the third one, have agreed to a contract with these workers and have agreed to a fair process for the workers in the non-union hotels. They did that earlier this summer. That's settled. Hilton and Starwood are being good players on this field.
Good.
Hyatt, however, is holding out and holding these people up from advancing in their lives and getting life back to normal.
You know, I look at this, and again, another one of those examples highlighting how broken and fractured the labor laws in this country really are. You know, workers are supposed to have the right to collectively bargaining and organizing, but what you've got is you've got situations like this where You've got companies who are they're going to do everything in their power to make sure your rights never happen.
You're absolutely right. I like to tell people that out of all of the industrialized countries, the U.S. has the worst labor laws. South Africa used to be below us, but with the abolishment of apartheid, South Africa has advanced above us, and so we remain at the rock bottom in the industrialized country.
Well, we're number one at something.
Yeah, but quite the wrong thing. Well, again, these workers have just been phenomenal. 98% of them are out on strike, or were out on strike. I still picture them on the picket line.
Right.
And the community just had an outpouring of support. We had clergy coming pretty much every day and leading prayers. Today, a Muslim organization sent over 200 sandwiches during lunchtime for the workers. Again, the Jewish community has just been outstanding in advocating for these workers. And believe me, the rabbis and cantors who are standing up to this kind of corporate aggression, you know, they are getting a little pushback from some of the people in their congregations who don't want any Jewish family, you know, smeared in the public arena.
Right. So let me ask you, going forward now, they're going to go back to work, I guess. What is the plan from this point forward? I mean, you've made the initial statement. There's public outcry. There's attention being brought to this. What's the push from here, do you think?
Well, the workers, by their own choice, have called for a boycott at Hyatt. And they don't take this situation lightly either. They realize that there could be repercussions for the number of hours per week that they work. But this is how deeply they believe in this. I could show you a list of groups across the country who have canceled their group contracts with the Hyatt Corporation. I believe there are over 50 of them now. And it's growing. And religious bodies such as mine in the United Methodist Church Northern Illinois Conference voted at our annual conference this June to boycott the Hyatt hotels. So this movement is growing. Hyatt is really suffering. They've marginalized themselves, and they're going to lose. They really need to back off of this aggressive stance that their managers have made.
And that's what collective action hopefully will produce. And, you know, I look at I better check my hotel reservations for this weekend because it better not be at a Hyatt because I will cancel my reservations. But, you know, at the end of this, that's what it's going to have to take. You know, it's going to have to have people standing behind these workers and, you know, standing up for them.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what Wisconsin taught us this year.
Absolutely.
That when we stand united, we can indeed get 100,000 people coming over and over again. We can get farmers and tractors. We can get high school and college students. We can get the elderly and young families sleeping on marble floors night after night, making a stance that this is our country and we want to take it back from the corporations who are running it and ruining our lives.
Let me ask you this last question I've got. You know, we hear all these horror stories about what these companies do to workers. And I saw one, and I almost can't believe it, but on a hot day, they turned heat lamps on the workers?
Yes, of course, in Chicago, we have some cold winters. Perhaps you do as well. And so one of the things that hotels have done over the years is to have these heat lamps. So when you come out into the cold and you're waiting for your taxi cab, you can have some warm heat on you. Well, when the Hyatt workers were picketing a few weeks back, and it was literally a 100-degree day, a manager flipped the switch and turned on those heating lamps above them, hoping to get them to move. And basically all that the Hyatt workers decided was, well, it's time to heat up the struggle even more.
And is there any unfair labor practice in this? Anything you can do against this? Did the Hyatt do anything? I mean, because that seems kind of outrageous to me.
It was a cruel action. That manager is no longer with the Hyatt.
By choice or by being removed?
It was tricky on how Hyatt handled that in the media. They said that the manager has retired. When a reporter said, would he have retired had he not flipped the switch on those heating lamps, they said, well, we're not going to address that, but he has moved on and he is now retired.
I'd love to see if he got a bonus, because you know, some of these places do that.
Yes. That's exactly right. The Hyatt is making millions and billions of dollars, and yet it leaves the workers who are really creating the hospitality for the guests in the hotel. It leaves them basically living in poverty with the way that they're being treated right now.
Well, that is the American way. Reverend C.J. Hawking, I appreciate the time. Executive Director of Arise Chicago. We've got a link to your website over at therickmithshow.com. Just click on the Reverend Hawking's name. It'll take you right there. Thanks so much. And as this progresses, please keep us informed on progress, please.
I would love to, Brett. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. I'll be right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we die away. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The Borowitz Report has a letter from Rick Perry. I'm not sure if Rick actually wrote this. It's quite possible. He said, this is what Rick Perry evidently wrote to the American people. Dear American, for the last few weeks, I've been under constant attack. My opponents would have you believe that if I'm elected, you'll be stripped of your Social Security benefits, and you'll be scourging for food and dumpsters, and with all that desperation of a feral cat. But, of course, that's just not true. But what they don't tell you is I'd replace Social Security with an amazing new program called PerryCare. That's right, PeriCare. Under PeriCare, you'll receive all the food, clothing, shelter, all the stuff you need. And it won't cost a dime in taxes. And how's that possible, you ask? Simple. Simple. You'll be praying for all those things. Simple stuff. As a PeriCare recipient, each week you'll receive an email in your box, a PeriCare prayer mail, giving you an easy-to-recite prayer for the bread, milk, cat food, or whatever else you need to survive. It's kind of like Groupon for God. PeriCare is more than a replacement for the infernal Ponzi scheme that has bamboozled Americans with regular monthly checks for 75 years. It's part of my larger plan to return prayer to its rightful place in American life. I get down on my knees every night, and I promise you, if I'm elected president, I will bring this entire country to its knees. I expect that some of my opponents will laugh at my plan, especially that lawn gnome Ron Paul and Michelle Crazy Eyes Bachman. Fine, let them laugh. Laughter is the best medicine, they say. And if I'm elected, there'll be no other medicine. That brings me to my PeriCare medical plan, which will replace Medicare once I can sign that Ponzi scheme to the electric chair of history. I don't have enough time to go on the whole plan right now, but here it is in two words, single prayer. Your next president, Governor Rick Perry. Do you think that came from Rick Perry's pen? I don't know. You know, sounds like him. Just hope and pray. Food will fall from the skies, like that movie, Cloudy Chances of Meatballs, that my kids love so much. You know, this whole healthcare debate thing to me. You know, ever since the thing with Ron Paul, where they actually got applause for letting someone die. I guess that's the Tea Party platform. Let them die. So Gingrich was on the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer yesterday talking about that very situation. And I can't imagine being in a room full of people who would cheer someone dying. I can't fathom. I can't fathom sitting next to somebody who is whooping and hollering, let him die! Screw him! I mean, does that make any sense to you on any level?
Well, I mean, this radical individualism, as you've talked about hundreds of times in this show, their idea is, well, you know, if we don't have a national health care, that'll benefit me because I won't have to pay for it. It's me. But what they fail to grasp in almost any level, and it's pretty simple logic, it comes down to enlightened self-interest. If we as a society don't protect our own, eventually 99.9% of the people will be affected.
So I look at Gingrich's response, and, you know, again, you know, it's that frame, the Ron Paul frame. But Gingrich said, historically, we had charity. We had places that say, if you're down and out on your luck, if you fail to be responsible, we will take care of you. But that doesn't mean you're necessarily going to get a private room. No. That you're necessarily going to get everything that somebody who took care of themselves and was prudent, what they got. No, you won't get all that. He says, yes, we're going to make sure that they're taken care of, but they ought to understand that that's charity. And Blitzer said, so what you're saying is the money shouldn't come from government, it should come from charity. And he goes, I prefer to see it come from charitable organizations. So you've got the Ron Paul vision. Is, well, you know, we always used churches to do it before. And now you got Gingrich sticking to the, and you got to give him credit, stick to his frame. You know, it's my frame, I'm sticking to it, even though it's a failure. You got him sticking to that. And, you know, obviously, right from the start, you would say if charity would have met the need, if it was able to meet the need, we wouldn't be where we are today. Because they're both right. We used to have churches who would help. We used to have charitable groups who used to help. And guess what? They did a really crummy job of it. And people died because of it. You know, I remember reading about poorhouses. I remember about reading about, the places where they would warehouse the infirmed. Not nice places. And that's where Gingrich and Paul want to take us back to. And it's that frame that you haven't been responsible. and you haven't done the, you haven't worked hard enough. Not that you were born into poverty and you haven't had the best of luck. You weren't fortunate enough to be in an area with decent jobs, whatever. It's your fault. And that's what I have a problem with. It's amazing. I mean, even Ronald Reagan, the guy that they hold up on the pedestal, realized that, charity ain't cutting it. And he passed the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. Which, you know what? Told the hospitals, you got to take care of people. If an uninsured person comes in, you got to take care of them. That was Reagan's doing. Under this Congress, with this T-Twizzler group, that would never happen. And you would see more people die. I mean, we see 45,000 people a year die because they can't get access to health care. I mean, if Gingrich had his way, maybe that would double. And maybe that's how they would solve the Social Security problem. Because as Santorum said, people are just living too long. You know, maybe we need to get them back to work, doing those hard labor jobs. Get you back in the chocolate, carrying those 100-pound bags, croak you a couple years early. Save me some money.
Well, you know, little Ricky obviously never worked hard physically in his life. He doesn't really understand to any degree the real realities of the workplace.
And here's the thing. You know, while we can pine for the days when charity took care of the poor and infirmed, which they didn't do a very good job of, a new Bloomberg poll out today shows that the support for repealing Obamacare only has 34% of the country favoring repealing it. That's down from 41% 6 months ago. Why? Because we're seeing more and more people uninsured. We're seeing more and more need, and it's affecting more and more people. And more people are going, wait a second, that you're on your own thing sounded great when I had health insurance, sounded great when I had a job. That you're on your own thing sounded really good when my union was making sure that I had a pension and health care and a decent wage, but bad trade policy shipped those jobs overseas. Now, better start looking at something else. And you look at this new Kaiser Health News report. At least 600,000 young adults under 26, and this is part of Obamacare, at least 600,000 of them have been able to get health insurance because of Obamacare, because they've been able to put on their parents' health plan. That's a good thing. And the Health and Human Services Department, originally they estimated there would only be 1.2 million. They're saying that there's going to be much more than that. It's going to be much higher than that because those kids coming out of college, they can't find jobs. And the jobs they do find, where do you think they are? They're in the service industry. And they don't have health care. And I look at this tweet from the Washington Post, Sarah Cliff. She tweeted that the Health Leadership Council, a group of 47 healthcare industry companies, you know, drug companies, insurance companies, you know, all the executives there, they have officially endorsed raising the Medicare eligibility age. So congratulations. You know, it's going to probably go up to 67, maybe 69, who knows, because they're saying, just jumping it up to 67, it's going to save the federal government about $124 billion over 10 years. And guess what? That means from 65 to 67, you'll either go with no insurance or you're going to pay really, really high insurance, high premiums. So dig a little deeper because the industry knows they got you. And finally, before we take a break, it appears as though, you know, everyone talks about we want to be a right-to-work state. We want Pennsylvania to be right-to-work. And you got Rick Perry saying we want to be a right-to-work country. And, you know, Mitt Romney, want to be a right-to-work country. Turns out 8 of the 10 states with the lowest percentage of insured folks, 8 of the 10, right-to-work. Texas being the number one. There's Mississippi right there, Florida, Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Arkansas, Louisiana. You want to be like that? I say no. We're back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. Back after this.
Take me for you. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Eventually, there will be a GOP debate where Governor Rick Perry is called out by a moderator for knowingly lying about the impact of the first stimulus on his state.
He had $800 billion worth of stimulus in the first round of stimulus. It created zero jobs.
That was the Texas governor responding to a question about jobs creation during the CNN Tea Party GOP debate on Monday. Moderator Wolf Blitzer failed to challenge the presidential candidate by presenting him with key facts. For one, Perry constantly touts his ability to create jobs, while failing to address how many of those jobs were created or saved by President Barack Obama's first stimulus plan. The Houston Chronicle reported in July of 2010 that Perry was the beneficiary of more than 47,000 jobs thanks to $17.4 billion in stimulus money he accepted from the federal government. In Houston alone, the stimulus dollars triggered 960 contracts, grants, and loans. The Congressional Budget Office also strongly disagrees with Perry's constant trumpeting that the stimulus didn't create any jobs. In the most recent report available from the nonpartisan organization, it found that anywhere from 1 million to 2.9 million jobs could likely be attributed to Obama's stimulus plan. It also credits the Recovery Act with reducing the unemployment rate by 0.5% to 1.6%.
I support a personal retirement account option in order to phase off the current system. We know that this works. It worked in the small country of Chile when they did it 30 years ago.
That was Godfather Pizza CEO and Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain touting Chile's privatized Social Security plan during the New Hampshire debate. It's a plan he's brought up in every debate since. What Cain fails to acknowledge in his comments is that Chile's system mandates that every worker must contribute 10% of earnings into a government-approved and regulated pension fund administration company. The government regulations are in place to ensure the PFAs provide a low-risk portfolio. One additional way the government isn't completely out of the picture is in making sure the system doesn't collapse due to individuals who couldn't make the minimum monthly payments. The government has a program that subsidizes low-wage earners when they reach retirement, costing the Chilean government $66 billion as of 2005. The system is in some ways similar to the Affordable Health Care Act, which Herman Cain is opposed to. That act mandates that U.S. citizens purchase minimal essential health care coverage. If they don't buy the coverage, an individual without insurance could be fined 2.5% of household income.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So the Republican congressman from Texas, Louie Gohmert, he has introduced legislation to the House today, the American Jobs Act of 2011. And, yes, that sounds an awful lot like the bill that President Obama just put out. His Jobs Act. But this one is on the Herman Cain platform. It's 2 pages long. And it probably could just be one. No corporate income tax. No corporate tax rate whatsoever. In fact, it's going to drop the corporate tax rate all the way down to zero. He wants to amend the IRA, the Internal Revenue Code of 86 to repeal all corporate income tax. You know, at least they're honest, at least they're consistent. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Helen on line one. How you doing tonight, Helen?
Hi, I was listening to the gentleman that was talking about the prisons. I was corresponding with a young man who was in jail in California. He was a hacker. And he was there at the time that Schwarzenegger came in, and they were ordered to cut the number of people in the prisons. So they cut everybody's prison sentence in half. His went from 6 to 3 years. But he said what was interesting is you had murderers. Nobody was being careful about who was being cut. It just went across the board. And he said there were some murderers that should have been left in there for, you know, just a few more years.
Yeah.
That had their sentences cut. Same thing with child molesters. He said it was scary the way they did it. And then they did it again, I guess, his 3 years. He was down to, like, 2 years, and they had to cut it again because I guess the feds didn't think they'd done enough. And he went down to, like, you know, he had, like, maybe eight months to go. He said they're doing the same thing again. They're not being careful with what, you know, watching who they're putting in this category of cutting their sentences. So you have to, you know, be very careful with this, who you let out.
I agree. There's a reason for prisons. And there are certain people, sorry, that's all they're going to ever, that's where they're going to be. And I want rapists and murderers and child molesters in places like that. I don't think drug offenses. Sorry, I don't think stealing meat from the Walmart.
Well, I'd like to disagree about the drug offenses. There's a young man at a place where I used to live. He bought a house from some drug dealers, and he, too, is involved with the pagans. And the ATF went in there and arrested him for gun charges, and lo and behold, there's crystal meth in the house, whether he was making it or whether he was just running it like he was with the guns. But he only did a couple of months, and he's out on house arrest. And there are children in that neighborhood, not a lot because it's a rural neighborhood, but you know, the people around there are, they say, oh, if you leave him alone, he doesn't bother you. But one woman said, he came and banged on my door 3 o'clock in the morning, and he was high as a kite.
Well, then I got a problem with that. But at the end of the day, my position is pretty simple. If you're using personal use of marijuana or drugs or whatever, and you're not bothering anybody, I'm sorry. I don't think you should be locked up for long terms. We have better things to do with those resources.
You know, there's a lot of people that don't realize just how bad marijuana is. I was driving back in the 60s with a doctor's son who was a, Princeton student, and I didn't realize he'd been smoking. And he was as bad on the road as as any drunk.
Yeah, but here again, this is a different crime we're talking about. If you're doing it irresponsible, it's like alcohol. You know, there are people who want to make alcohol legal again. And I don't have a problem with people who drink, but just don't get on the road and just don't do dumb other things with it. That's pretty much my opinion on it. And I shouldn't be spending $40,000 a year to lock you up.
They do tend to be very annoying, and they can be very dangerous to those of us who live next to them. You know, that's the problem. You know, you have somebody smoking marijuana in the house next to you in a place that's a row home. You can't get away from that secondhand smoke. So
there you go. All righty. Well, I appreciate it, Helen. Thanks so much. Yeah, I look at that. To be honest, I don't know many potheads that are all that aggressive. Most of them are kind of just a little laid back. But yeah. To each his own, I guess. Here's an interesting story. I had a couple people email me this. And again, if you want to email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, I do appreciate the information. We do have some of the smartest listeners in the radio world. But here it is. This guy, Kent Snyder, evidently was a campaign chief for Ron Paul. A 49-year-old man passed away, viral pneumonia. You know, somebody who worked for, you know, Reagan's campaigns, worked for Ron Paul, did a lot of work. A smart guy, graduated from San Francisco's Golden Gate University, has, you know, had a master's degree from Georgetown University. This is an intelligent guy with considerable opportunity. In fact, worked for Ron Paul. Here's the problem. Got viral pneumonia, ended up going into the hospital, and he passed away. And to kind of make it look, you know, to kind of go and you look at Ron Paul's statement the other day, here this guy left a $400,000 hospital bill because he had no insurance. Working for Ron Paul, no insurance. Now, who picked up that $400,000? You and I did. Why? Here's a smart guy. Smart guy. Had every opportunity in the world to do the right thing. Had every opportunity. Made probably really good money for Ron Paul. He couldn't afford insurance. Or he, I shouldn't say couldn't afford. He chose not to. So you and I, we the taxpayers, we're on the hook for that. Does that make any sense?
No, and you're getting into one of the basic arguments that, you and I and those who, feel that we need a national health care. If everybody's covered on an individual basis, the cost goes down. It's pretty simple. But until we get to that time, we're going to have a hodgepodge system, and quite frankly, the costs are going to keep going up and up and up until we get to that point.
So what they did is they set up this fund to help pay his bills. But at the end of the day, you and I, we still covered this. So when Ron Paul talks about, oh, gee, you know, well, you know, you've got to be responsible for yourself, and, oh, you know, we'll have private charity take care of it. You know who the private charity in this event was? You and me. We are the charitable people.
And it would be interesting to see what Ron Paul says about that.
And I'm waiting for it because the story just broke, and I got it from a number of people. And again, you know, you stop and you think about this stuff. It's nice verbiage. It's a nice position. I like freedom. I like liberty. Leave me alone. And if I don't want insurance, I shouldn't have to have it. But I know very few people who, when that heart attack comes, says, no, don't call the doctor. I know very few people who fall out of a window and break both their legs who say, no, I will take care of it myself.
Well, in Ron Paul's perfect world, in that situation where the man's in desperate need, unless a charitable organization can take care of him, he shouldn't get health care. But as you said, how many people are going to say, well, no, I want to die. Leave me alone. My political philosophy means more than my life. You know that isn't going to happen.
So back, you know, what was it, 2008, July of 2008, when this guy passed away, Ron Paul said, like so many in our movement, Kent sacrificed so much for the cause of liberty. He poured every ounce of his being into our fight for freedom and his fight not to have health insurance and you and I to get stuck with the bill. And this is, again, this is my reasoning for the mandate. There has to be something in this that all of us pay into this system so that everyone's covered and we're not left on the hook for someone like this. Or doesn't that make sense? I mean, when I drive my car down the road, I have some security in knowing that the guy who's driving in the other lane, like the other morning coming in here, guy just decided, I'm going to make a left-hand turn right in front of you. And had I not locked him up and almost flipped the car over, I would have mashed right into him. But I knew, had I hit him, almost assured that he would have some type of insurance and that I would be covered. But in healthcare, we don't have that. And that, to me, is just nuts. Just plain nuts. Anyway, have you seen this report? Daryl Issa evidently being charged with some ethics violations. This group, the American Family Voices, they've charged that he doing a little covering up, doing a little some bizarre pressure on the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, to halt investigations into Goldman Sachs. I think that's going to be kind of interesting to see if this goes anywhere, because he's a guy who likes to investigate everything, well, except the banking industry and except evidently Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, because evidently they're not going to hold any hearings into what's going on with Rupert and the people over at Fake News. But they're claiming that he used his authority to put his nose into a whole bunch of this financial stuff. And they're saying it yielded him huge, huge payouts. So it's going to be interesting to see where this takes us and where we end up going on down the road. Because, you know, ICE has been one of those guys who just absolutely loves to do the investigating. It loves to start picking into people. But, you know, when it's his turn, not so much. We need to let that go. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Tomorrow, there will be tomorrow.
for the better.
It's bedtime, children. Get on your jammies, scooch under the covers, and I'll tell you another fairy tale. In this one, Prince Rick is trying to make it to the big White House in Washington. It's a strange quest because he calls the capital city, quote, a seedy place. And he tells the commoners in the land that he hates, nay, deeply loathes, the very government that he wants to head. With his Tea Party hat carefully positioned atop his bounteous crop of perfectly coiffed hair, Prince Rick warns the commoners that big government is bad, 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 because it intrudes into their lives, forcing things like Social Security and Medicare on them. Strangest of all, though, this prancing prince of privilege would not be where he is without the steady intrusion of big government into his life. From first grade through college, his education was paid for by local, state, and federal taxpayers. Also, as cotton farmers, he and his family were supported with thousands of dollars in crop subsidies from the pockets of national taxpayers. Then, after a brief stint as a government-paid Air Force transport pilot, the perfidious prince hit the mother lode of government largesse, political office, where he's been for 27 years and counting. In addition to drawing more than a quarter century's worth of monthly paychecks from Texas taxpayers, Prince Rick also receives full health coverage and a generous pension benefit from the state, plus $10,000 a month to rent a luxury home, a flock of personal aides, and even a state-paid subscription to Food and Wine magazine. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, children, the moral of this fairy tale is to ignore the prince's hypocritical hype and look at what he actually does. When Rick Perry says he intends to make government, quote, as inconsequential as possible, what he means is in your life, not in his.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So, roughly 5,400 former congressional staffers and about 400 former U.S. lawmakers have become lobbyists in the last 10 years, and you've had 605 former lobbyists who have left K Street to work for members of Congress in the last 10 years. And, you know, this is in a report published by the people over at Legastorm. They're this online disclosure site, and the founder of Legastorm says, you know, this represents a large network of people to influence decision and to provide valuable intelligence. And what it says to me is there's very little difference between lobbyists and legislators. It's this cozy, incestuous kind of cesspool where they're, you know, it's just a fluid relationship where, hey, if I'm good to you, you'll give me a job when I leave. And, hey, oh, by the way, I need somebody to work for me. Come on over and do this work. I mean, it's just nuts. And it hasn't always been this way. And I was watching one of the hearings yesterday when I got home from the show. And they were interviewing Alan Greenspan. He was testifying along with a couple of other economists, and I don't remember their names. But Greenspan was talking about the tax reform bill of 86. And I've talked about this a number of times, how the con that they used was much like the con they used during the Kennedy years when they dropped that top marginal rate from 92% down to 70 and closed some loopholes, which they did, and it brought in for a short period of time some additional revenue. But then, you know, the lobbyists went back to work and they got their little nibbles here and little bites there. We did the same thing in 86, where they closed a whole bunch of corporate loopholes and they lowered the rate again. You know, nice kind of the same thing we're hearing now, though. Oh, we need to lower that rate. And Gohmert, he wants to lower it to zero, but they want to lower it again. Bring down the capital gains rate, bring down the corporate tax rate, bring down the top marginal tax rate. Because, you know, if we bring these down, people will pay their taxes. And I keep going, why not just hire enforcement people to make them pay their taxes? Why do we have to lower it to where they go, oh, well, gee, you know, well, now we'll pay it? But Greenspan, in a moment of candor and just a true honesty, goes, look, we did this, and the next day they were already at work putting these loopholes back. The next day. And he said, you know, the thing is, you know, it's going to happen again. You'll lower this down, and the next day lobbyists will come in because it's too easy for politicians to do this stuff. It's too easy to, and it makes sense a lot of times. Like, you know, oh, hey, you know, we need to give XYZ Corporation a tax break so they'll create some jobs. And we go, oh, yeah, we need jobs. Tax breaks create jobs because that's what we've been indoctrinated to believe. So we go ahead and do it. And then that tax break, you know, becomes one of these loopholes where they avoid paying taxes. And they set up trusts and they set up little P.O. boxes in places like Delaware to where they can, you know, funnel profits out. And we end up getting screwed in this. And I keep saying, well, why don't we have just strong enforcement and have an active, informed electorate that says, you know what, no more of this stuff. Stop with the tax cuts creates jobs. Hasn't worked. Demand, my friends. That is what creates jobs. And like the solar panel situation, one case, we gave them a guaranteed loan to start up a factory and to hire workers and to do a whole startup. In another case, we said, you know what? We want to put solar panels on our military bases. Go ahead and do that. And we'll give you money after the fact, once they're up and they're operational. That's what I'm in favor of. That seems to be the smart thing. Or am I missing the point? Evidently not. So here's an interesting story. How many people are on Facebook? They say some 750 million people. In fact, we're on Facebook, Rick Smith or The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk, you know, our two Facebook pages. You can take a look at it over there. But evidently, Facebook has now, they're going on a hiring binge. I mean, they're just going crazy hiring. They have announced they're hiring a director of privacy. You gotta love this. This Erin Egan, she is an expert in privacy and data security. She's a lawyer with the firm Covington and Burling. She will take the reins of her new post sometime mid-October, according to a company statement. She has extensive experience in legislative and regulatory efforts, they say. You know, privacy, data security, spam, spyware, identity theft, all that stuff. She's going to work in Washington. Can you say lobbyist? Because that's what I think she's probably going to be. So then they ramped up their lobbying arm. They hired this other woman, Louisa Terrell. She right now working for the Obama administration, but she's going to go over and work as the director of public policy for Facebook. Again, lobbyist. And they hired another woman, Erica Mann, former member of the European Parliament from Germany. She's going to head their Brussels office. Another lobbyist, going to lobby the EU nations. And, you know, I think about this. Privacy on Facebook, really? Good luck on that. But here is something that has me worried. And to be honest, I think we should all be concerned. The Supreme Court, and again, if you need any reason to vote against Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, this is kind of it. All of these Supreme Court decisions that have been coming down, limiting workers' rights, limiting consumer rights, on the side of business, because this court has been the most business-friendly probably in history. But this case, this Jones, the United States versus Jones, here's what happened. Cops thought it'd be a good idea to tail Mr. Jones, so they put a GPS on his car, and they tailed and they followed him electronically all over the place for an entire month. Does that warrant unreasonable search and seizure? I would think it does. The lower courts are saying no. So later, late this month, early next month, the Supreme Court is going to hear this case. And I'm predicting it's probably going to end up being, let it happen. Which is really scary to me on a number of levels because we all have these smartphones, we've all got cell phones, we've all got these devices. Who's to say that the police, that they're not following you everywhere you go? And it being perfectly legal. I mean, that to me is a scary proposition. And you look at the fact that the two lower appellate courts have upheld it, saying, well, you know, they can, what the heck? Now, you've got this one judge who's going, wait a second. His name is Douglas Ginsburg. He's with the U.S. Appeals Court for the District of Columbia. He's saying, no, wait a second. And his argument's pretty reasonable. He says, no reasonable person expects that his public movements will be tracked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and therefore we have to expect privacy in the whole of our public movements. He says, unlike one's movement in a single journey, the whole of one's movement over the course of a month is not actually exposed to the public because the likelihood anyone would observe all of those movements effectively nil. So it's an interesting position he's taken. I agree. Now, do I want criminals to be able to, you know, to escape the law of justice? No, but I want you to do it in the right way. And here's the catch. Get a warrant. That's the reason we have the process. Get a warrant. Is that hard?
No, it's supposed to be the protection that our founding fathers put into our judicial system. Oftentimes, though, we don't really value that protection.
So Ron Wyden and Representative Joseph Chaffetz, a Republican from Utah, they've come forth with the Geological Privacy and Surveillance Act. And what it's going to do is it's going to provide some federal protection against that kind of public surveillance. Look, at the end of this, it's pretty simple. And to me, it doesn't take a rocket science. You want to track somebody? You want to follow them? Go in front of a court. Go to the court. Get a warrant. That's the way you do that. That's the way you think things should be done. But again, since 9/11, we've kind of thrown habeas corpus out the window and any privacy rights kind of out the window. When you look at the Patriot Act, man, really? they can come into my house and put bugs in my house, don't have to tell me, and don't have to tell a court, and then only have to go back later? Really? That's where we're going, folks. Scary, scary stuff. And you look at what happened on 9/11. Two planes, they quarantined. One because a couple were engaging in, intimate relations in the bathroom, and they were in there too long. So if you got to go to the bathroom on the plane, don't go too long. What you do, go a little bit. Buckle up, come out, go, got to go back, and go back in. You know, you kind of make it a couple of times. You know, squeeze it off there in the middle. Evidently, that's the lesson we have to learn. Now, this other case, you know, there's the case of the couple, you know, wanting to be part of the Mile High Club, and congratulations, good for them. If you can do that in that little bathroom, God bless you. I can barely stand in one of those little bathrooms. If you can do that, God bless you. You deserve to have that title of Mile High Club. The other case, some brown people. There was a row of brown people, two Indian men, and a half Arab, half Jew named Shahano Habishi. Evidently, the housewife from Ohio. It was so dangerous that they had to send a bunch of cops with in military fatigues with automatic rifles onto the plane after they had quarantined it off. From the way she tells the story, as you saw these, you know, these military people running onto the plane with guns, you know, everybody put your head down, hands on the seat. Walked up to these three, handcuffed them, grabbed them pretty forcefully, took them off, interrogated, strip searched them. And then decided, yeah, you weren't really a threat. Just had to go to the bathroom. And do you know why all of this happened? Because the two Indian guys, and remember, if you're on a plane, don't sit next to the Indian guys. Because they're going to get you in trouble. And I think that's the lesson she had to learn here. Because each one of them had to go to the bathroom one after the other. Yeah, see? Don't sit next to the Indian guys. So that was the whole reason. And the government's saying, well, you know, we need to be... ever vigilant, we need to have err on the side of caution, we need, you know, more vigilance and all that, because she was suspicious. Going to the bathroom, two Indian guys, that's in succession, that's suspicious. And I got to be honest, you know, there was one time, it was a while ago, I ate some Indian food, and it kind of made me go a couple of times. So I hope if I fly again, Well, chances of me eating Indian food probably slim to none at this point. But if I have to go, it's gonna be short spurts.
So you didn't like the curry? Huh?
No, not a big curry fan. Now that's a
all
reason
those
to
spices?
That's a reason to get him off the plane. But that's a whole different discussion for a whole other day. And I wouldn't want to strip search him, to be honest. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, you look at the picture of the woman, and, you know, again, I'm going to take a beating over this. Maybe worth strip searching. You know, just a thought. And, you know, maybe they got into that. I don't know. Oh, come on. Have a sense of humor. But is this what we've come to? Two Indian guys can't go to the bathroom. We're going to quarantine the plane. We're going to have all those resources. I don't know. Just nuts. And I know. What would have happened if they had put a bomb in the thing?
So I guess my question is, and maybe I'm thinking too much, who exactly were these people that showed up with automatic weapons? Local cops?
No, federal marshals.
Federal marshals? Okay.
You know what I find interesting? You know, there was just a story that just came out, and you probably saw it too. That in talking about 9/11, when they had to scramble the jets, that they scrambled the jets from the 121st Fighter Squadron there in D.C., the Air National Guard, when they were scrambling the jets to intercept Flight 93, that they sent the jets up without any missiles, without any weapons. And the plan was that the pilots would ram Flight 93 because they evidently couldn't shoot it down. What does that say about our preparedness at the time? What does that say about how insane our policies were that you couldn't leave just one, maybe armed?
I'm a little confused why they couldn't be armed. They didn't have the ammunition.
They had to scramble them. They had to get them up in the air. You got to go now. Don't worry about it. Just ram. Take the plane down. Kamikaze if you have to. That's what the pilots were told. It's an amazing story.
Wow.
The pilot, her name is Lieutenant Heather Penny. She was one of the people who said, you know what? One option was
basically a
kamikaze.
Suicide mission.
Take them out. And, you know, we had this conversation, you know, Brett and I had it earlier today, and, you know, you go, really? That's the plan? I'm going to go up and I'm going to fly the plane into another plane? And, you know, he was saying, like he said, you know, that's what those pilots, that's their job, man. And, you know, God bless them. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Ken Bazinet from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Sitting at the kitchen table with Tom and his laptop.
My name's Tom, and I'm here today to learn how to save money on my prescriptions with Capital Blue Cross.
Capital's VP of Pharmacy Services, Meenock, is here. She's showing Tom how to use the Capital website to learn his prescription price before he heads to the pharmacy today.
You would want to know what is the cost of that medication to basically stretch your health care dollar, because that's your dollar.
The point is, members have options to save time and money. And if Tom wants to log on at 1 a.m. to renew a prescription, that's fine, too.
Having that flexibility to be able to order prescriptions at any time of the day or night is fantastic. And the mail order feature is really like a self-service feature. We love that.
Meenock doesn't usually make house calls, but today she's happy to help.
This is one of the ways we care more, so we do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, you got to love that they're all back in session in Washington. So all the backbiting and the snipping and the gridlock back in full force and right there in front of us so we can see it. And here to talk to us a little bit about what's going on in the big city there is Ken Bazinet, Talk Radio News Service. Ken, what's going on in D.C. today?
How are you, my friend? Same old, same old. Two trains, 150 miles an hour, headed at each other on the same track. But one of the interesting things is a couple of these trains, to use that horrible metaphor, are actually from the same company. Turns out that the president's very ambitious $447 billion jobs bill is coming under fire by some unexpected folks. That would be the Democrats.
Was there any surprise that the Democrats, you know, again, you know, they've always been the party of you know, circle the wagons and shoot inward?
Well, that's true. We're seeing a little bit of that from the Republicans, obviously, too, between the East Coast establishment capitalistas versus the Tea Party contingency. But the thing that's interesting or scary, I suppose, if you're a Democrat, is that, you know, you would think, given the fact that the president is so much under fire, that the fact that the White House is really their only play to keep the Republicans from passing any legislation that would be anti-worker, anti-family, anti-American, in some quarters some would say, is the fact that they have the veto at the White House and they're not yet coalescing. The big disagreement this time is that they're just afraid that another large, ambitious jobs bill will be son of stimulus, and the Republicans will hammer them, and it'll cost them next year at the polls. Now, the interesting thing for you folks and your listeners, obviously, is one of the biggest detractors, or skeptics at least, is Senator Bob Casey, the Democrat from Pennsylvania. He's basically saying that people are just skeptical of these pieces of legislation.
I agree people are skeptical because the first one I don't believe was big enough and it was focused too much on tax cuts, not enough on actual doing. And this, to be honest, to me, a little bit too heavily focused on tax cuts and not enough doing. I mean, I look at the solar panel thing. I talked about it earlier. The company that we said, here's loan guarantees, they're the company that went belly up. The company that we said, oh, hey, by the way, when you're done putting them on the military bases, then we'll pay you. That's the one that's doing fine.
Well, that's very true. That's very true. What Casey is suggesting is break the bill up. Don't do it as one. Do it a la carte, which, as you know, the House Republicans are probably going to force that anyway.
Right.
You know, I think the feeling of a lot of people, and by the way, what's really interesting is David Axelrod, the president's so-called political guru, was on one of the morning network programs earlier this week, and saying, no, this is an all-or-nothing deal. And by that afternoon, the White House was saying out loud, no, we're open to discussion on this thing.
So is there a surprise that they caved that quickly? I'm surprised as soon as he said it, there wasn't a press release before he got off the show that, no, we'll cave.
Yeah. This is not an administration whose obituary will say they had a lot of backbone.
No, and what bothers me, and we talked about this a little earlier, what bothers me is the fact that he's not doing anything, Obama's not doing anything to help himself in next November. And what scares me to death is that we end up in 2012 through 2016, you end up appointing one, possibly two Supreme Court justices. And if it ends up with somebody like Rick Perry or Romney or who knows, with the right-wing wrecking crew, this country has changed for generations.
Right, right. No, absolutely. That's a very good observation. There are some people who actually have suggested that it would be in the best interest of the Democratic Party if some of the elders considered retiring before the election.
No, I think I got to be honest. I think they're going to lose the Senate anyway.
Right.
Just the numbers are just against them.
Right.
Maybe.
What's really a shame is I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
And I looked at her video today a couple of times. I'm a Massachusetts guy, as I think you know.
And yeah, we can hear that.
In a three-decker in an industrial city, you know, son of a union guy, grandson of a union family. And Elizabeth Warren has an incredible message to tell, an incredible story to tell about the destruction of the middle class,
right,
and the emerging oligarchy in our society that just doesn't care about working people, particularly union families. And instead, we got the Harvard Law School professor today. And that's very troubling because if you know anything about Massachusetts politics, Cambridge, Amherst, Bridgewater, the great intellectual centers of Massachusetts do not deliver a statewide election. Fall River, New Bedford, Worcester, Pittsfield, Springfield, Lowell, those are the cities that do.
Yep.
And I just worry that she's not going to play there.
Do you think she's taken some, you know, some Shrum advice or some of the other Democratic strategists who are adept at losing quite often? Do you think she's taken the wrong advice?
I think if she's taking the wrong advice, it's coming from inside the intellectual circles that she travels in. You know, that Cambridge is a bastion. I don't have to tell you of you know, big ideas and good people and smart people. There's no question about it. But they don't know diddly about the death of the rusting industrial cities of Massachusetts and how people live.
Yeah, I've been to Lawrence a number of times, and I look at that building that used to make shoes. I think it was with the Rockport factory.
Sure.
It was it was a couple miles long. I mean, it's the majority of the city, and it's completely empty. The windows are smashed out. That was an industrial center at one point that we just let go because of our insane trade policies.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
What she should do is she should buy a beat-up old pickup truck, put on a pair of blue jeans, and go around to shake people's hands and try and look like one of us.
Yeah, no, that's it. There's a way that it can be done that doesn't look like she's selling out or, you know, just completely, you know, pandering. But that video, after you get off there, you should take a look at it. And it's on, I posted it on my blog, The Baz File. You can see it there, and I did an analysis along with it, which basically goes along these lines. Now, some people are criticizing me, saying, you know, how can you, you know, just dismiss her that way? I'm not dismissing her that way. You know, I'm trying to explain to her that an election in Massachusetts, of which I know a thing or two about, since I come from a very political family and I have a political background aside from my journalistic background as well, is not about, you know, the head of the Charles Regatta. It's about, you know, third down on the goal line, and the Patriots need to fill the hole with some beef.
Well, I think all she has to do is look at the last election, where you had probably the worst candidate in the history of running campaigns.
Yeah. Margaret Coker.
Marthy Coakley. A horrible, horrible candidate who, you know, why would I go to the Bruins game?
Right. Took Christmas off, did the whole nine yards, you know. The press in Massachusetts are notorious for those questions. She's going to get asked, you know, who is Stalker LaMacchia? You know, she's going to get asked, what's the 2020 club? She's going to get asked sports questions like that.
Yeah.
And believe me, Massachusetts is not a state that has been kind to statewide women candidates. One after another have run for high office, and they've gotten their clocks cleaned. And it's those kind of, you know, sort of inconsequential things that people, you know, really take to heart. They want candidates who they can connect with. And, you know, Scott Brown was a genius during that last election.
He did all the things.
The Tea Party of Massachusetts thought he was one of them.
Yep. Well, you know, he did everything that you had to do to win that election, especially when you had an opponent that didn't understand it.
That's right.
And just drummed her fingers on the desk and waited to be anointed. That was basically
I thought for sure the way that Brown ran that election, that, you know, Massachusetts actually is going to contribute to the Tea Party. And then he got to the Senate, and he started voting a lot like those moderate Republicans up in Maine.
Yeah, because he wants to get reelected. I mean, he's got to go home to those people.
Oh, but there are ideologues, as you are well aware, who were elected in the class of 2010 who, you know, do not care about, you know, what it takes to get reelected. They just hold their line.
Yeah.
Brown is, at least he's got, you know, the political instincts to know what it takes to get elected in Massachusetts. I think the guy, listen, she needs Obama coattails in Massachusetts at this point.
Yeah.
And he's not even wearing a coat at this point. You know what I mean?
I hear you.
She probably could use Mitt Romney on the top of the ticket simply because that carpetbagger is despised in Massachusetts right now.
Good point. And we'll see how that all works itself out. You know, I got to be honest. I was happy to see her jump in. It's a name that I think is recognizable. Somebody who, you know, can say, you know, I was persecuted by the GOP. Look, I should be the head of that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And what they've done is, you know, they railroaded me out of town.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and don't just play the victim, but go on yourself, say, because they were afraid of me.
That's it. Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Because they know what I stand for. They know that I care about union families. They know that I care about working families. They know that I care about the middle class. And quite frankly, I care about the wealthy, too, because without regulations, they can be hurt as much as anyone else. It's a powerful message.
Yep.
But say it that way.
Yeah, it's going to be excellent to watch this this unfold before our eyes, because I think she's going to, I hope she runs a good campaign, and we will see. Ken Bezanet, I appreciate the time and the good conversation. Talk to you again soon.
Pleasure's all mine, sir.
Our good friend Ken Bezanet, Talk Radio News Service, and now to find out what's going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Story coming out of Washington. We talked Washington D.C. We talked about this story before with the Republicans. Have held up a funding bill for the FAA. The Republicans were angry because there was going to be a change in the new FAA funding provision, which would change the way that union elections would have occurred within the airline industry. Prior to this, if there was a union election and those that didn't vote were counted as a no vote, under the new regulations, it would simply be a plurality. Republicans were outraged. They claimed that this was a gift to the unions, and they refused to pass it. Well, there were protests, there were rallies, and the public became aware that it affected 4,000 FAA jobs. Also, 70,000 construction jobs were stopped, and there was a cost to taxpayers of about $400 million. Some of the key Republicans who were holding it up heard it from their constituents. They have backed off now and have agreed to pass a bill, and that bill also contains, by the way, federal highway programs through March. Now, here's the thing. They will agree to it this time, but you can bet that they will not give up on that issue, especially since they have the majority in the House, and stay tuned on that issue. You're going to hear more about that in the future. Former Wiener seat, it's caused a lot of consternation among Democrats nationally.
Wiener seat.
The Democrats lost that seat, a seat that they held since, believe it or not, 1923. It's the former seat of Charles Schumer. When he was a congressman before he went to the Senate, that was his seat. And they lost, it wasn't really that close. They lost by about 8 points. The Republicans are claiming, well, that was because of the unpopularity of Barack Obama. The truth was, within that district, there was a poll held recently by the public policy polling, which said that Barack Obama's approval rating in that district was about 31%, whereas in 2008 he won that district by about 55%. Now, the one problem he had was with the Jewish community because of Barack Obama's position on the key issue of negotiations with the Arabs. Barack Obama said he wants them to go back to the 1967 demarcation lines, and the Jewish community has been outraged about that, and he lost a lot of support. However, there was more to it than that. He apparently, the Democrat, ignored some key constituents. He ignored some of the Hispanics and the Asians. And the truth was, and this is kind of disheartening for Democrats, since September 11th, 2001, the Catholics who are Irish and Italian, and plus it's some of the Hispanics and Asians, have tended to vote more conservative, and they are voting more and more for Republicans. In fact, According to the numbers I saw, it has been the largest since 2000 to 2008. It has been the largest shift towards the GOP in any district outside the South. That should be really worrisome to the Democrats. They also complain that the Democrat campaign failed to reach out effectively to the sizable Asian and Hispanic community. So what I'm saying is, part of it was Obama, but there were also some real mistakes by the Democrat, and hopefully this is not a national trend, and I don't believe that it is. Basic adult. We've talked about this before, and there's been another development. Adult basic was discontinued. Blue Cross Blue Shield decided that they weren't going to fund it. Adult basic, for those of you who don't know, in Pennsylvania, covered those who made too much to get health care for the poor, Medicaid, but who couldn't afford to buy it out on the market. They replaced it with special care. Special care was a very mediocre policy that actually increased the cost by about 450%. It limited the doctor's visits to about 4 per year, and it did very little for pre-existing conditions. Blue Cross Blue Shield has then applied for about a 9% increase. There were a lot of letters sent, protests, phone calls made, and now Blue Cross Blue Shield has decided to take that down to about 4.9. Now, the advocates for healthcare are saying, look, we believe that Blue Cross Blue Shield is doing this to avoid public hearings. They're pushing for public hearings. I was surprised when I heard this figure. It's been about 10 years since an insurance commissioner has held a rate review hearing in our state. 10 years. Maybe it's about time we start having something and look at some of these outrageous rate increases when it comes to insurance. According to The Hill, an Interior Department Coast Guard report faults HP and the contractors for the Gulf oil spill. The Joint Interior Department U.S. Coast Guard report on the fatal Deepwater Horizon disaster, which claimed 11 lives in April last year, lays the groundwork for another set of interior rules that further toughens drilling standards. Here's the thing. HP was definitely guilty. Some of the subcontractors in this report have also been charged with some misdemeanors, not misdemeanors, but lack of foresight. They have also been accused of making some big mistakes. But at the end of the day, many of the fishermen in the Gulf still haven't been able to get back to the same fishing levels prior to the still. Actuaries, wetlands, and hundreds of miles of beach that haven't recovered from the oil pollution to this day. The deaths of about 11 of the platform workers. BP can never really do enough to pay back the debt that they owe to the families of the dead and to those who earn their living in the Gulf or the entire environment of the Gulf region. It's good to see that the report has laid some blame, but I think BP has a lot to answer for.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. We're right back to wrap things up.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
This is the most unfortunate situation that I have seen in a long time in Washington as a result of one or two people who just really were not willing to compromise. They wanted their way. And as a result of them wanting their way, 70,000 construction workers are idle in construction projects around America at airports, and 4,000 FAA employees are not receiving paychecks and haven't received paychecks for more than 10 days.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, that's where you go to download the podcast. Or if you've got one of these smartphones, get the Stitcher app so you can take the program with you on the go. Our last story of the evening, and it's one of those, you know, have you ever been to like a Chinese spa? You know, there's some rumors that go around. You go to the Chinese spa, and there's something called a happy ending. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Maybe yes, maybe no. Well, this Chinese guy happened to go to a spa, and he had a very unhappy ending, if you will, because I guess he climbed into the bath with live eels. Evidently, the live eels are supposed to cleanse the skin. I don't know that I would get into a tub full of slithering live eels, but that's what this gentleman did, this Chinese gentleman did. And he says, I climbed into the bath, and I could feel the eels nibbling my body. But then, all of a sudden, I felt a severe pain. And I realized that a small eel had gone into the end of my manhood, slithered its way all the way up, and disappeared into the bladder. Evidently, he was going in without shorts on, and it crawled up the, and it had to be a small eel, had to go to the hospital 3 hours. So instead of a relaxing, exfoliating bath, he had a 3-hour surgical procedure where they increased the diameter of his urethra. That's what the little tube's called, just to go in there and get the quite slippery little eel. What in God's name would make you step into a bath with eels, with little eels all over the place, and with the intention that they're going to bite me? Well, good luck. Here you go, buddy. You got bitten. So I hope it was worth all of the trouble. There, my friends, is your happy ending for the evening. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming. To the USA.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.